Interlude. Up the River. 1. Jean was away at the House of Glass Roses the afternoon that Locke found out he was going to be sent up the Angevine to live on a farm for several months. Hard rains were pounding Camor that idler's day, so Chains had taken Locke, Carlo, and Galdo down into the dining-room to teach them how to play Rich Man, Beggar Man, Soldier Man, Duke, a card game that revolved around attempting to cheat one's neighbour out of every last bent copper at his disposal. Naturally, the boys took to it quickly.
2, 3, and 5 of spires, said Carlo, plus the sigil of the 12. Die screaming, half-wit, said Galdo. I've got a run of chalices and the sigil of the sun. Won't do you any good, quarter-wit. Hand over your coins.
Actually, said Father Chains, a sigil run beats a sigil stand, Carlo. Galdo would have you, except...
Doesn't anyone care what I've got in my hand? Asked Locke.
Not particularly, said Chains, since nothing in the game tops a full duke's hand. He set his cards on the table and cracked his knuckles with great satisfaction.
That's cheating, said Locke. That's 6 times in a row, and you've had the duke's hand for 2 of them.
Of course I'm cheating, said Chains. Game's no fun unless you cheat. When you figure out how I'm cheating, then I'll know you're starting to improve.
You shouldn't have told us that, said Carlo. We'll practice all week, said Galdo. We'll be robbing you blind, said Locke, by the next idler's day.
I don't think so, said Chains, chuckling, since I'm sending you off on a 3-month apprenticeship on Penance Day.
You're what?
Remember last year when I sent Carlo off to Lashain to pretend to be an initiate in the Order of Gandalo, and Galdo went to Ashmere to slip into the Order of Sendovani? Well, your turn's come. You'll be going up the river to be a farmer for a few months.
A farmer?
Yes, you might have heard of them.
Chains gathered the cards from around the table and shuffled them. They're where our food comes from.
Yes, but I don't know anything about farming.
Of course not. You didn't know how to cook, serve, dress like a gentleman, or speak Vadran when I bought you either. So now you're going to learn something else new.
Where?
Up the Angevine, 7 or 8 miles. Little place called Villa Senziano. It's tenant farmers, mostly beholden to the Duke or some of the minor swells from the Alcigrante. I'll dress as a priest of Dama Elisa, and you'll be my initiate, being sent off to work the earth as part of your service to the goddess. It's what they do.
But I don't know anything about the Order of Dama Elisa.
You won't need to. The man you'll be staying with understands that you're one of my little bastards. The story's just for everyone else.
What, said Carlo, are we going to do in the meantime?
You'll mind the temple. I'll only be gone 2 days. The eyeless priest can be sick and locked away in his chambers. Don't sit the steps while I'm away. People always get sympathetic if I'm out of sight for a bit, especially if I cough and hack when I return. You two and Jean can amuse yourselves as you see fit, so long as you don't make a bloody mess of the place.
By the time I get back, said Locke, I'll be the worst card player in the temple. Yes, best wishes for a safe journey, Locke, said Carlo. Savour the country air, said Galdo. Stay as long as you like.
2. The 5 towers loomed over Camor like the upstretched hand of a god. 5 irregular, soaring, elderglass cylinders, dotted with turrets and spires and walkways, and much curious evidence that the creatures that had designed them did not quite share the aesthetic sense of the humans who'd appropriated them. Easternmost was Dawncatcher, 400 feet high, its natural colour a shimmery silver-red, like the reflection of a sunset sky in a still body of water. Behind it was Blackspear, slightly taller, made of an obsidian glass that shone with broken rainbows like a pool of oil. At the far side, as one might reckon by looking across the five with Dawn Catcher in the middle of one's vision, was West Watch, which shone with the soft violet of a tourmaline, shot through with veins of snow-white pearl. Beside it was stately amber glass, with its elaborate flutings from which the wind would pull eerie melodies. In the middle, tallest and grandest of all, was Raven's Reach, the palace of Duke Nicovante, which gleamed like molten silver, and was crowned with the famous sky garden, whose lowest hanging vine trailed in the air some 600 feet above the ground. A network of glassine cables, miles and miles of spun elderglass cords had been found in the tunnels beneath Camor centuries before, threaded the roofs and turret tops of the five towers. Hanging baskets passed back and forth on these cables, drawn along by servants at huge clacking capstans. These baskets carried both passengers and cargo. Although many of the residents of Lower Camor proclaimed them mad, the nobles of the five families regarded the lurching, bobbing passage across the yawning empty spaces as a test of honor and courage. Here and there, large cargo cages were being drawn up or lowered from jutting platforms on several of the towers. They reminded Locke, who stared up at all this with eyes that were not yet sated with such wonders, of the spider cages at the Palace of Patience. He and Chains sat in a two-wheeled cart with a little walled space behind the seat, where Chains had stashed several parcels of goods under an old canvas tarp. Chains wore the loose brown robes with green and silver trim that marked a priest of Dama Eliza, mother of rains and reaping. Locke wore a plain tunic and breeches, without shoes. Chains had their two horses, ungentled, for Chains misliked using the white-eyed creatures outside city walls, trotting at a gentle pace up the winding cobbles of the Street of Seven Wheels, the heart of the Millfalls district. In truth, there were more than seven wheels spinning in the white froth of the Angevine. There were more in sight than Locke could count. The five towers had been built on a plateau some 60-odd feet above the lower city. The Alchigrante Islands sloped up toward the base of this plateau. The Angevine came into Camor at that height, just to the east of the five, and fell down a crashing 6-story waterfall nearly 200 yards across. Wheels turned at the top of these falls, within a long glass and stone bridge topped with wooden mill houses. Wheels turned beneath the falls as well, jutting out into the river on both sides, making use of the rushing white flow to work everything from grinding stones to the bellows that blew air across the fires beneath brewers' vats. It was a district choked with business folk and labourers alike, with escorted nobles in gilded carriages rolling here and there to inspect their holdings or place orders. They turned east at the tip of the Millfalls and crossed a wide, low bridge into the Chenza Gate district, the means by which most northbound land traffic left the city. There was a great mess, barely controlled by a small army of yellow jackets. Caravans of wagons were rolling into the city, their drivers at the mercy of the Duke's tax and customs agents, men and women marked by their tall black brimless caps, and commonly referred to, when out of earshot, as vexationers. Petty merchants were pitching everything from warm beer to cooked carrots. Beggars were pleading countless improbable reasons for impoverishment and claiming lingering wounds from wars that had obviously ended long before they were born. Yellow jackets were driving the most persistent or malodorous off with their black lacquered sticks. It was not yet the 10th hour of the morning. "You should see this place around noon," said Chains, "especially during harvest time, and when it rains. Gods!" Chain's clerical vestments and a silver solon passed over in a handshake got them out of the city with little more than a "good day, your holiness." The Chenza gate was 15 yards wide, with huge ironwood doors almost as tall. The guardhouses on the wall were occupied, barracks-like, not just by the city watch, but by the blackjackets, Camor's regular soldiers. They could be seen pacing here and there atop the wall, which was a good 20 feet thick. North of Camor proper was neighbourhood after neighbourhood of lightly built stone and wooden buildings, arranged in courts and squares more airy than those found on the islands of the city itself. Along the river bank there were the beginnings of a marsh. To the north and east were terraced hills, crisscrossed by the white lines of boundary stones set out to mark the property of the families that farmed them. The air took on divergent qualities depending on which way the chance breezes blew. It would smell of sea salt and wood smoke one minute, of manure and olive groves the next.
"Here beyond the walls," said Chains, "is what many folks living outside the great cities would think of as cities. These little scatterings of wood and stone that probably don't look like much to someone like you. Just as you haven't really seen the country, most of them haven't truly seen the city. So keep your eyes open and your mouth shut, and be mindful of differences until you've had a few days to acclimate yourself."
"What's the point of this trip, Chains, really?"
"You might one day have to pretend to be a person of very lowly station, Locke. If you learn something about being a farmer, you'll probably learn something about being a teamster, a barge poleman, a village smith, a horse physicker, and maybe even a country bandit."
The road north from Camor was an old Therinthrone road, a raised stone expanse with shallow ditches at the sides. It was covered with a gravel of pebbles and iron filings, waste from the forges of the coal smoke district. Here and there the rains had fused or rusted the gravel into a reddish cement. The wheels clattered as they slid over these hard patches.
"A lot of black jackets," Chains said slowly, "come from the farms and villages north of Camor. It's what the Dukes of Camor do when they need more men, and they can afford to wait a bit without raising a general levy of the low-born. It's good wages, and there's the promise of land for those that stay in service a full 25 years, assuming they don't get killed, of course. They come from the north, and mostly they go back to the north."
"Is that why the black jackets and the yellow jackets don't like each other?"
"Eh," Chain's eyes twinkled. "Good guess. There's some truth to it. Most of the yellow jackets are city boys that want to stay city boys. But on top of that, soldiers can be some of the cattiest, most clannish damn folk you'll ever find outside of a high-born lady's wardrobe. They'll fight over anything. They'll brawl over the colours of their hats and the shapes of their shoes. I know, believe me."
"You pretended to be one once?"
13 gods, no. I was one."
"A black jacket?"
"Yes."
Chains sighed and settled back against the hard wooden seat of the horse cart.
30 years passed now. More than 30. I was a pikeman for the old Duke Nicovante. Most of us from the village my age went. It was a bad time for wars. Duke needed fodder. We needed food and coin."
"Which village?"
Chains favoured him with a crooked smile.
"Villa Senziano. Gods, it was a whole pile of us that went."
The horses and the cart rattled down the road for a few long moments before Chains continued.
"There were 3 of us that came back, or at least got out of it."
"Only 3?
"That I know of."
Chains scratched at his beard.
"One of them is the man I'm going to be leaving you with, Vandross. A good fellow, not book-smart, but very wise in the everyday sense. He did his 25 years, and the Duke gave him a spot of land as a tenancy."
"Tenancy?"
"Most common folk outside the city don't own their own land any more than city renters own their buildings. An old soldier with a tenancy gets a nice spot of land to farm until he dies. It's a sort of allowance from the Duke."
Chains chuckled.
"Given in exchange for one's youth and health."
"You didn't do the 25, I'm guessing."
"No."
Chains fiddled with his beard a bit more, an old nervous gesture.
"Damn, I wish I could have a smoke. It's a very frowned-on thing in the Order of the Dharma, mind you. No, I took sick after a battle. Something more than just the usual shits and sore feet. A wasting fever. I couldn't march, and I was like to die, so they left me behind. Myself and many others. In the care of some itinerant priests of Perelandro.
But you didn't die.
Clever lad, said Chains, to deduce that from such slender evidence after living with me for just 3 years.
And what happened?
A great many things, said Chains, and you know how it ends. I wound up in this cart, riding north and entertaining you.
Well, what happened to the third man from your village?
Him? Well, said Chains, he always had his head on right. He made Banneret sergeant not long after I got laid up with the fever. At the Battle of Nesek, he helped young Nicovante hold the line together when old Nicovante took an arrow right between his eyes. He lived, got elevated, and served Nicovante in the next few wars that came their way.
And where is he?
At this very moment? How should I know? But, said Chains, later this afternoon he'll be giving Jean Tannen his usual afternoon weapons lesson at the House of Glass Roses.
Oh, said Locke.
Funny old world, said Chains. 3 farmers became 3 soldiers. 3 soldiers became 1 farmer, 1 baron, and 1 thieving priest.
And now I'm to become a farmer for a while.
Yes, useful training indeed, but not just that.
What else?
Another test, my boy. Just another test.
Which is?
All these years you've had me looking over you. You've had Carlo and Galdo and Jean and Sabatha from time to time. You've gotten used to the temple as a home. But time's a river, Locke, and we've always drifted farther down it than we think.
He smiled down at Locke with real affection.
I can't stand watch on you forever, boy. Now we need to see what you can do when you're off in a strange new place all on your own.
Chapter 8. The Funeral Cask. 1. It began like this, with the slow, steady beat of mourning drums and the slow cadence of marchers moving north from the floating grave, red torches smouldering in their hands, a double line of blood-red light stretched out beneath the low, dark clouds. At its heart was Vencarlo Barsavi, cupper of Camor, with a son at either hand. Before him was a covered casket draped in black silk and cloth of gold, carried at either side by 6 pallbearers, one for each of the 12 Therin gods, dressed in black cloaks and black masks. At Barsavi's back was a huge wooden cask on a cart pulled by another 6 men, with a black-shrouded priestess of the Nameless 13th close behind. The drums echoed against stone walls, against stone streets and bridges and canals. The torches cast reflections of fire in every window and shred of elderglass they passed. Folk looked on in apprehension, if they looked on at all. Some bolted their doors and drew shutters over their windows as the funeral procession passed. This is how things are done in Camor, for the rich and the powerful. The slow, mournful march to the Hill of Whispers, the interment, the ceremony, and then the wild, tearful celebration afterward. A toast on behalf of the departed, a bittersweet revel for those not yet taken for judgment by Azaguia, Lady of the Long Silence. The funeral cask is what fuels this tradition. The lines of marchers left the wooden waste just after the 10th hour of the evening and marched into the cauldron, where no urchin or drunkard dared to get in their way, where gangs of cutthroats and gaze addicts stood in silent attention as their master and his court walked past. Through coal smoke they marched, and then north into the quiet, as silvery mist rose warm and clinging from the canals around them. Not a single yellow jacket crossed their path, Not one constable even caught sight of the procession. Arrangements had been made to keep them busy elsewhere that night. The east belonged to Barsavi and his long lines of torches, and the farther north he went, the more honest families bolted their doors and doused their lights, and prayed that the business of the marchers lay far away from them. Had there been many staring eyes, they might have noticed that the procession had already failed to turn toward the Hill of Whispers, that it had instead gone north and snaked toward the western tip of the Rust Water District, where the great abandoned structure called the Echo Hole loomed in the darkness and the fog. A curious observer might have wondered at the sheer size of the procession, more than 100 men and women, and at their accoutrements. Only the pallbearers were dressed for a funeral. The torchbearers were dressed for war, in armor of boiled leather with blackened studs, in collars and helmets and braces and gloves, with knives and clubs and axes and bucklers at their belts. They were the cream of Barsavi's gangs, the hardest of the right people, cold-eyed men and women with murders to their names. They were from all of his districts and all of his gangs, the Red Hands and the Rum Hounds, the Grey Faces and the Arsenal Boys, the Canal Jumpers and the Black Twists, the Catchfire Barons and a dozen others. The most interesting thing about the procession, however, was something no casual observer could know. The fact was, Nazca Barsavi's body still lay in her old chambers in the floating grave, sealed away under silk sheets, alchemically impregnated to keep the rot of death from setting in too quickly. Locke Lamora and a dozen other priests of the Nameless Thirteenth, the Crooked Warden, had said prayers for her the previous night, and placed her within a circle of sacred candles, there to lie until her father finished his business this evening, which had nothing to do with the Hill of Whispers. The coffin that was draped in funeral silks was empty. 2.
"I am the Grey King," said Locke Lamora. "I am the Grey King, God's damn his eyes, I am the Grey King."
"A little lower," said Jean Tannen, struggling with one of the grey cuffs of Locke's coat, "and a little scratchier. Give it a hint of Tal Verar. You said he had an accent."
"I am the Grey King," said Locke, "and I'll be smiling out the other side of my head when the gentleman bastards are through with me." "Oh, that's good," said Carlo, who was streaking Locke's hair with a foul-scented alchemical paste that was steadily turning it charcoal grey. "I like that one. Just different enough to be noticed."
Locke stood stock still as a tailor's mannequin, surrounded by Carlo, Galdo, and Jean, who worked on him with clothes cosmetics and threaded needles. Bug leaned up against one wall of their little enclosure, keeping his eyes and ears alert for interlopers. The gentleman bastards were hidden away in an abandoned storefront in the fog-choked Rustwater district, just a few blocks north of the Echo Hole. Rustwater was a dead island, ill-favoured and barely inhabited. A city that had thrown off its old prejudices about the structures of the Eldrin still held Rustwater in an unequivocal dread. It was said that the black shapes that moved in the Rustwater lagoon were nothing as pleasant as mere man-eating sharks, but something worse, something older. Whatever the truth of those rumours, it was a conveniently deserted place for Barsavi and the Grey King to play out their strange affair. Locke privately suspected that he'd been taken somewhere in this neighbourhood on the night the Grey King had first interrupted his life. They were working every trick of their masquerade art to fashion Locke into the Grey King. Already his hair was grey, his clothes were grey, he was dressed in heavy padded boots that added 2 inches to his height, and he had a drooping grey moustache firmly affixed above his lips.
"It looks good," said Bug, an approving note in his voice.
"Damn showy, but Bug's right," said Jean. "Now that I've got this stupid coat cinched in to your proper size, you do look rather striking."
"Pity this isn't one of our games," said Galdo. "I'd be enjoying myself. Lean forward for some wrinkles, Locke."
Working very carefully, Galdo painted Locke's face with a warm, waxy substance that pinched his skin as it went on. In seconds it dried and tightened,
and in just a few moments Locke had a complete network of crow's feet, laugh lines, and forehead wrinkles. He looked to be in his mid-40s at the very least. The disguise would have done very well in the bright light of day. At night it would be impenetrable.
"Virtuoso," said Jean, "relatively speaking, for such short notice and the conditions we have in which to put it all together."
Locke flipped his hood up and pulled on his grey leather gloves.
"I am the Grey King," he said, his voice low, mimicking the odd accent of the real Grey King.
"I bloody well believe it," said Bug.
"Well, let's get on with everything then." Locke moved his jaw up and down, feeling the false wrinkle skin stretch back and forth as he did so. "Galdo, hand me my stilettos, would you? I think I'll want one in my boot and one in my sleeve."
"Lamora,"
came a cold whisper, the falconer's voice. Locke tensed, then realized that the noise hadn't come from the air.
"What is it?" asked Jean.
"It's the falconer," said Locke. He's doing that damned thing."
"Barsavi will soon be at hand. You and your friends must be in place ere long."
"We have an impatient bondsmage," said Locke. "Quickly now. Bug, you know the game, and you know where to put yourself."
"I've got it down cold," said Bug, grinning. "Don't even have a temple roof to jump off this time, so don't worry about anything."
"Jean, you're comfortable with your place?"
"Not really, but there's none better."
Jean cracked his knuckles. "I'll be in sight of Bug down beneath the floor. If the whole thing goes to shit, you just remember to throw yourself down the damn waterfall. I'll cover your back, the sharp and bloody way." "Carlo, Galdo." Locke whirled to face the twins, who had hurriedly packed away all the tools and substances used to dress Locke up for the evening. "Are we good to move at the temple?"
"It'll be smoother than a gilded lily's backside if we do," said Galdo. "A sweet fat fortune wrapped up in sacks, 2 carts with horses, provisions for a nice long trip on the road. And there's men at the Viscount's gate who'll slip us out so fast it'll be like we'd never even set foot in Camor in the first place," added Carlo.
"Good. Well, shit." Locke rubbed his gloved hands together. "I guess that's that. I'm all out of rhetorical flourishes, so let's just go get the bastards and pray for a straight deal." Bug stepped forward and cleared his throat.
"I'm only doing this," he said, "because I really love hiding in haunted Eldrin buildings on dark and creepy nights."
"You're a liar," said Jean slowly. "I'm only doing this because I've always wanted to see Bug get eaten by an Eldrin ghost."
"Liar," said Carlo. "I'm only doing this because I fucking love hauling half a ton of bloody coins up out of a vault and packing them away on a cart." "Liar," Galdo chuckled. "I'm only doing this because while you're all busy elsewhere, I'm going to pawn all the furniture in the borough at No Hope Hawser's."
"You're all liars,"
said Locke as their eyes turned expectantly to him. "We're only doing this because nobody else in Camor is good enough to pull this off, and nobody else is dumb enough to get stuck doing it in the first place."
"Bastard!" they shouted in unison, forgetting their surroundings for a bare moment.
"I can hear you shouting," came the ghostly voice of the falconer. "Have you all gone completely mad?"
Locke sighed. "Uncle doesn't like us keeping him up all night with our carrying on," he said. "Let's get to it, and by the grace of the crooked warden, we'll all see each other back at the temple when this mess is over."
3. The echo hole is a cube of grey stone mortared with a dull sort of elder glass. It never gleams at false light. In fact, it never returns the reflection of any light passed before it. It is perhaps 100 feet on a side, with one dignified entrance, a man-sized door about 20 feet above the street at the top of a wide staircase. A single aqueduct cuts from the upper Angevine past the millfalls, south at an angle and into Rustwater, where it spills its water into the heart of the echo hole. Like the stone cube itself,
This aqueduct is thought to be touched by some ancient ill, and no use has ever been made of it. A small waterfall plunges through a hole in the floor, down into the catacombs beneath the echo hole, where dark water can be heard rushing. Some of these passages empty into the canal on the southwestern side of Rustwater. Some empty into no place known to living men. Loch Lamora stood in darkness at the center of the echo hole, listening to the rush of water down the break in the floor, staring fixedly at the patch of greyness that marked the door to the street. His only consolation was that Jean and Bug, crouched unseen in the wet darkness beneath the floor, would probably be even more apprehensive, at least until the proceedings started.
"Near," came the voice of the falconer, "very near. Stand ready."
Locke heard the copper's procession before he saw it. The sound of funeral drums came through the open door to the street, muffled and nearly drowned out by the falling water. Steadily it grew louder. A red glow seemed to kindle beyond the door, and by that light Locke saw that the grey mist had thickened. Torches flickered softly, as though glimpsed from underwater. The red aura rose. The barest outline of the room around him became visible, etched in faint carmine. The beating of the drum ceased, and once again Locke was alone with the sound of the waterfall. He threw back his head, placed one hand behind his back, and stared at the door, his blood pounding in his ears. Two small red fires appeared in the doorway like the eyes of a dragon from one of Jean's stories. Black shadows moved behind them, and as Locke's eyes adjusted to the influx of scarlet light, he saw the faces of men, tall men, cloaked and armoured. He could see enough of their features and posture to see that they were almost surprised to spot him. They hesitated, then continued forward, one moving to his left and the other to his right. For his part, he did nothing, moving not a muscle. Two more torches followed, and then two more. Barsavi was sending his men up the stairs in pairs. Soon a loose semicircle of men faced Locke, and their torches cast the interior of the echo hole into red-shaded relief. There were carvings on the walls, strange old symbols in the tongue of the Eldrin, which men had never deciphered. A dozen men, two dozen. The crowd of armoured shapes grew, and Locke saw faces that he recognised. Throat-slitters, leg-breakers, maulers, assassins. A hard lot. Exactly what Barsavi had promised him when they'd stood looking down at the body of Nazca together. Moments passed. Still Locke said nothing. Still men and women filed in. The Barangius sisters, even in a dimmer light, Locke would have recognised their swagger. They stood at front and centre of the gathering crowd, saying nothing, arms folded and eyes gleaming in the torchlight. By some unspoken command, none of Barsavi's people moved behind Locke. He continued to stand alone, as the great press of right people continued spreading before him. At last the crowd of cutthroats began to part. Locke could hear the echoes of their breathing and murmuring and the creaking of their leathers bouncing from wall to wall, mingling with the sound of falling water. Some of those on the edges of the crowd extinguished their torches with wet leather pouches. Gradually the smell of smoke seeped into the air, and gradually the light sank, until perhaps one in five of the copper's folk were still holding lit fires. There was more than enough light to see Kappa Barsavi as he turned the corner and stepped through the door. His grey hair was pulled back in oiled rows. His three beards were freshly brushed. He wore his coat of sharkskin leather and a black cloak of velvet lined with cloth of gold, thrown back from one shoulder. Andres was on his right and Panchero on his left as the Kappa strode forward, and in the reflected fires of their eyes Locke saw nothing but death.
"Nothing is as it seems," came the voice of the falconer. "Stand resolute."
At the front of the crowd Barsavi halted, and for a long moment he stared at the apparition before him, at the cool orange eyes with a shadowed hood, at Locke's cloak and mantle and coat and gloves of grey.
"King,"
he finally said.
"Kappa,"
Locke replied, willing himself to feel the hauteur, conjuring it forth from nothing. The sort of man who would stand in front of 100 killers with a smile on his face. The sort of man who would summon Vencarlo Barsavi with a trail of corpses, the last of them his only daughter. That was the man Locke needed to be. Not Nazca's friend, but her murderer. Not the Kappa's mischievous subject, but his equal, his superior. Locke grinned, wolfishly, then swept his cloak back from his left shoulder. With his left hand he beckoned the Kappa, a taunting gesture, like a bully in an alley, daring his opponent to step forward and take the first swing.
"Oblige him," said the Kappa, and a dozen men and women raised crossbows.
"Crooked warden," thought Locke, "give me strength." He ground his teeth in expectation. He could hear his jaw muscles creaking. The snap hiss of release echoed throughout the hall. A dozen taut strings twanged. The bolts were too fast to follow, dark afterimages that blurred the air, and then a dozen narrow black shapes rebounded off nothing right before his face and fell clattering to the floor, scattered in an arc like dead birds at his feet. Locke laughed, a high and genuine sound of pleasure. For one brief moment he would have kissed the falconer if the bondsmage had stood before him.
"Please," he said, "I thought you'd listen to the stories." "Just establishing your bona fides," said Kappa Barsavi. "Your Majesty."
The last word was sneered. Locke had at least expected a certain wariness following the blunting of the crossbow attack, but Barsavi stepped forward without apparent fear.
"I'm pleased that you've answered my summons," Locke replied. "The blood of my daughter is the only thing that summoned me," said Barsavi.
"Dwell on it if you must," said Locke, praying silently as he extemporized.
"Nazca, gods, please forgive me."
"Were you any gentler when you took this city for yourself 22 years ago? Is that what you think you're doing?"
Barsavi stopped and stared at him. They were about 40 feet apart.
"Taking my city from me? I summoned you to discuss the matter of Camor," said Locke, "to settle it to our mutual satisfaction."
The falconer hadn't interrupted him yet. He presumed he was doing well.
"The satisfaction," said Barsavi, "will not be mutual."
He raised his left hand, and one man stepped from the crowd. Locke peered at this man carefully. He seemed to be an older fellow, slight and balding, and he wasn't wearing armor. Very curious. He also appeared to be shivering.
"Do as we discussed, Aemon," said the Kappa. "I'll hold true to my bargain, truer than any I've ever made."
The unarmored man began to walk forward, slowly, hesitantly, staring at Locke with obvious fear. But still he kept coming, straight toward Locke, while 100 armed men and women waited behind him, doing nothing.
"I pray," said Locke, with a bantering tone, "that man isn't contemplating what I suspect." "We'll all see what his business is soon enough," said the Kappa. "I cannot be cut or pierced," said Locke, "and this man will die at my touch." "So it's been said," replied the Kappa.
Aemon continued to move forward. He was 30 feet from Locke, then 20.
"Aemon," said Locke, "you are being ill-used. Stop now."
Gods, he thought, don't do what I think you're going to do. Don't make the falconer kill you. Aemon continued to shamble forward. His jowls were quivering, and he was breathing in short, sharp gasps. His hands were out before him, shaking like a man about to reach into a fire. Crooked warden, Locke thought, please let him be scared. Please let him stop. Falconer, please put a fright into him. Do anything else but kill him. A river of sweat ran down his spine. He bent his head slightly and fixed Aemon with a stare. 10 feet now lay between them.
"Aemon," he said, striving for a casual tone and not entirely succeeding, "you have been warned. You are in mortal peril."
"Oh, yeah," said the man, his voice quavering. "Yeah, that I know."
And then he closed the distance between them, and he reached out for Locke's right arm with both of his hands. Fuck, thought Locke, and although he knew deep down that it would be the falconer killing the man and not himself, he flinched back from Aemon's touch. Aemon's eyes lit up. He gasped, and then, to Locke's horror, he leapt forward and grabbed Locke's arm with both of his hands, like a scavenger bird clutching at a long-delayed meal.
"Ah!"
he cried, and for one brief second Locke thought something terrible was happening to him. But no, Aemon still lived, and he had a very firm grip. "Double fuck," Locke mumbled, bringing up his left fist to clout the poor fellow, but he was off balance, and Aemon had him at a disadvantage. The slender man gave Locke a shove backward, screaming once again,
"Ah!"
A cry of absolute triumph. Locke puzzled over it as he fell flat on his ass. And then there were booted feet slapping the stones behind Aemon, and dark shapes rushing around him to grab at Locke. In the dancing light cast by 2 dozen moving torches, Locke found himself hauled back up to his feet, pinned by strong hands that clutched at his arms and his shoulders and his neck. Kappa Barsavi pushed through his eager crowd of men and women, forced Aemon more gently to the side, and stood face to face with Locke, his fat, ruddy features alight with anticipation.
"Well, Your Majesty," he said, "I'll bet you're one confused son of a bitch right about now."
And then Barsavi's people were laughing, cheering. And then the copper's ham-hock fist planted itself in Locke's stomach, and the air rushed out of his lungs, and black pain exploded in his chest. And then he knew just how deeply in the shit he truly was. 4.
"Yes, I'll bet you're pretty goddamned curious at this point," said Barsavi, strutting back and forth in front of Locke, who remained pinioned by 6 men, any one of them half again his size.
"And so am I. Let's throw that hood back, boys."
Rough hands yanked at Locke's hood and mantle, and the Kappa stared coldly at him, running one hand up and down his beards.
"Grey, grey, grey. You look like you belong on a stage," he laughed. "And such a skinny fellow, too. What a weak little man we've caught ourselves tonight. The Grey King, sovereign of fog and shadows and precious little else."
The Kappa backhanded him, grinning. The stinging pain had just registered when he did it again from the other direction. Locke's head lolled. He was grabbed from behind by his hair and made to look the Kappa right in the face. Locke's thoughts whirled. Had the Kappa's men somehow located the falconer? Had they distracted him? Was the Kappa mad enough to actually kill a bondsmage if he had the chance?
"Oh, we know you can't be cut," continued Barsavi. "And we know you can't be pierced, more's the pity. But bruised? It's a curious thing about the spells of a bondsmage. They're so damn specific, aren't they?"
And then he punched Locke in the stomach again, to a murmur of widespread amusement. Locke's knees buckled beneath him, and his attendants hoisted him again, holding him upright as bolts of pain radiated from his abdomen.
"One of your men," said Barsavi, "strolled into my floating grave this very morning."
A little chill crept down Locke's spine.
"Seems I'm not the only one you pissed off when you sent my Nazca back to me the way you did," said Barsavi, leering. "Seems that some of your men didn't sign on with your merry little crew for that sort of god's damn desecration.
So your man and I, we had ourselves a talk, and we fixed a price. And then he told me all sorts of fascinating things about that spell of yours, and that story about you being able to kill men with a touch. Oh, he told me it was bullshit.
Sewn up, said a little voice at the back of Locke's head that most certainly was not the Falconer. Sewn up, sewn up. Of course the Falconer hadn't been distracted or taken by any of Barsavi's men. Neat as a god's damned hanging.
But I was only willing to trust the fellow so far, Barsavi said. So I made a deal with Aemon, who I'm sure you don't recognize. Aemon is dying. He has the cold consumption, the tumors in his stomach and his back, the sort no physica can cure. He's got maybe 2 months, maybe less.
The copper clapped Aemon on the back as proudly as if the skinny man were his own flesh and blood.
So I said, why don't you step up and grab the filthy little bastard, Aemon? If you really can kill with a touch, well, you'll go quick and easy. And if he can't?
Barsavi grinned, his red cheeks wrinkling grotesquely.
Well, then. 1,000 full crowns, said Aemon, giggling. For starters, added Barsavi, a promise I intend to keep, a promise I intend to expand. I told Aemon he'd die in his own villa, with gems and silks and 6 ladies of his choice from the Gilded Lilies to keep him company. I will invent pleasures for him. He'll die like a fucking duke, because tonight I name him the bravest man in Camor.
There was a general roar of approval. Men and women applauded, and fists banged on armor and shields.
Quite the opposite, Barsavi whispered, of a sneaking, cowardly piece of shit who would murder my only daughter, who wouldn't even do it with his own hands, who'd let some fucking hireling work a twisted magic on her, a poisoner.
Barsavi spat in Locke's face. The warm spittle trickled down his cheek.
Your man told me, of course, that your bondsmage had set his spell and left your services last night. That you were so very confident you didn't want to keep paying him. Well, I, for one, applaud your sense of economy.
Barsavi gestured to Andres and Pachero. Grim-faced, the two men stepped forward. They slipped their optics off and put them in vest pockets, an ominous gesture conducted in unconscious unison. Locke opened his mouth to say something, and then the realization of exactly how sewn up he was struck him cold. He could proclaim his true identity, have the kappa tear off his false moustache and rub away the wrinkles, spill the entire story, but what would it gain him? He would never be believed. He'd already displayed a bondsmage's protection. If he confessed to being Locke Lamora, the 100 men and women here would be after Jean and Bug and the Sansas next. If he was going to save them, he had to play the Grey King until the kappa was finished with him, and then he would pray for a quick and easy death. Let Locke Lamora just vanish one night. Let his friends slip away to whatever better fate awaited them. Blinking back hot tears, he summoned up a grin, looked at the two Barsavi sons and said,
"By all means, you fucking curs, let's see if you can do any better than your father."
Andres and Pachero knew how to strike a man with the intent to kill, but just now they had no such intent. They bruised his ribs, knuckle-punched his arms, kicked his thighs, slapped his head from side to side, and punched him in the neck until every breath was a chore. At last, Andres had him hoisted back up and took hold of his chin so that the two of them were looking eye to eye.
"By the way," said Andres, "this is from Locke Lamora."
Andres balanced Locke's chin on one finger and walloped him with his other hand. White-hot pain shot through Locke's neck, and in the red-tinted darkness around him he saw stars. He spat blood, coughed, and licked his sore, swollen lips.
"Now," said Barsavi, I'll have a father's justice for Nazca's death.
He clapped his hands 3 times. Behind him, there was an audible noise of men cursing and heavy footfalls banging against the stone steps. Through the door came 8 more men, carrying a large wooden cask, a cask the size of the one Nazca Barsavi had been returned to her father in, the funeral cask. The crowd around Barsavi and his sons parted eagerly to let the cask haulers through. They set it on the ground beside the kapa, and inside it Locke heard the slosh of liquid.
Oh, 13 gods, he thought. Can't be cut, can't be pierced, said the kapa, as though he were musing out loud. But you can certainly be bruised, and you certainly need to breathe.
2 of the kapa's men popped the lid on the cask open, and Locke was dragged over to it. The eye-watering stench of horse urine spilled out into the air, and he gagged, sobbing.
"Look at the Grey King cry," whispered Barsavi. "Look at the Grey King sob, a sight I will treasure to the last hour of my dying day."
His voice rose.
"Did Nazca sob? Did my daughter cry as you gave her her death? Somehow I don't think so."
The kapa was shouting now.
"Take a last look! He gets what Nazca got. He dies as she died, but by my hand."
Barsavi seized Locke by the hair and tilted his face toward the barrel. For one brief, irrational moment, Locke was grateful that there was nothing in his stomach to throw up. The dry retching still brought spasms of pain to his much-abused stomach muscles.
"With one small touch," said the kapa,
actually gulping back sobs of exhilaration.
"With one small touch, you son of a bitch! No poison for you. No quick way out before I put you in. You get to taste it the whole time, all the while as you drown in it."
And then he hefted Locke by the mantle, grunting. His men joined in, and together they hoisted him up over the rim. And then down he plunged, face first, down into thick, lukewarm filth that blotted out the noise of the world around him, down into darkness that burned his eyes and his cuts and swallowed him whole. 5. Barsavi's men slammed the lid back onto the barrel. Several of them hammered it down with mallets and axe butts until it was cinched tight. The kapa gave the top of the barrel a thump with his fist and smiled broadly. Tears were still running down his cheeks.
"Somehow I don't think the poor fucker did as well as he hoped with our negotiations."
The men and women around him whooped and hollered, arms in the air, torches waving and casting wild shadows on the walls.
"Take this bastard and send him out to sea," said the kapa, gesturing toward the waterfall.
12 pairs of eager hands grabbed at the barrel. Laughing and joking, a crowd of the kapa's people hoisted it and carried it over to the northwestern corner of the echo hole, where water poured in from the ceiling and vanished into blackness through a fissure about 8 feet wide.
"One," said the leader, "two,"
and on the cusp of 3, they flung the barrel down into darkness. It struck water somewhere beneath them with a splash. Then they threw up their arms and began cheering once again.
"Tonight," cried Barsavi, "Duke Nicovante sleeps safe in his bed, locked away in his glass tower. Tonight the Grey King sleeps in piss, in a tomb that I have made for him. Tonight is my night. Who rules Camor?"
"Barsavi," came the response from every throat in the echo hole, reverberating around the alien-set stones of the structure, and the kapa was surrounded by a sea of noise, laughter, applause.
"Tonight," he yelled, "send messengers to every corner of my domains. Send runners to the last mistake. Send runners to catch fire. Wake the cauldron and the narrows and the dregs and all the snare.
Tonight I throw open my doors. The right people of Camor will come to the floating grave as my guests. Tonight we'll have such a revel that the honest folk will bar their doors, that the yellow jackets will cringe in their barracks, that the gods themselves will look down and cry, "What is that fucking racket?" "Barsavi, Barsavi, Barsavi," his people chanted. "Tonight," he said at last, "we will celebrate. Tonight Camor has seen the last of kings."
Interlude, The Half-Crown War. 1. As time went by, Locke and the other gentleman bastards were occasionally set free to roam at leisure, dressed in ordinary clothing. Locke and Jean were getting on near 12. The Sansas were visibly slightly older. It was more difficult to keep them cooped up beneath the house of Perelandro all the time, when they weren't sitting the steps or away on Father Chain's apprenticeships. Slowly but steadily, Chains was sending his boys out to be initiated in all the great temples of the other 11 Therin gods. One of them would enter a temple under a false name, sped along by whatever strings Chains could pull and whatever palms he could slip coins into. Once there, the young gentleman bastard would inevitably please his superiors with his scribing, his theological knowledge, his discipline, and his sincerity. Advancement came quickly, as fast as it could be had. Soon the newcomer would receive training in what was called interior ritual, the phrases and activities that priests only shared among themselves and their initiates. They were not quite secrets, these things. To any priest of a Therin order, the thought of someone being audacious enough to offend the gods by falsely seeking initiation was utterly alien. Even those who knew of the slightly heretical idea of the 13th, and even the minority who actually believed in him, failed to imagine that anyone would want to do what Chains and his boys were doing. Invariably, after several months of excellent accomplishments, each sterling young initiate would die in a sudden accident. Carlo favoured drowning, for he could hold his breath a very long time, and he enjoyed swimming underwater. Galdo preferred to simply disappear, preferably during a storm or some other dramatic event. Locke constructed elaborate little mummeries that took weeks to plan. On one occasion he vanished from the Order of Nara, plague mistress, lady of ubiquitous maladies, by leaving his initiate's robe, torn apart and splashed with rabbit's blood, wrapped around his copywork and a few letters in an alley behind the temple. Thus enlightened, each boy would return and teach the others of what he had seen and heard. "The point," said Chains, "is not to make you all candidates for the High Conclave of the 12, but to allow you to throw on whatever robes and masks are required, and pass as a priest for any short period of need. When you're a priest, people tend to see the robe rather than the man." But there was no apprenticeship underway at the moment. Jean was drilling at the House of Glass Roses, and the other boys waited for him on the southern edge of the shifting market, on a crumbling stone pier at the end of a short alley. It was a warm spring day, breezy and fresh, with the sky half occluded by crescents of grey and white clouds sweeping in from the northwest, heralding storms. Locke and Carlo and Galdo were watching the results of a collision between a chicken seller's boat and a transporter of cats. Several cages had flown open when the small boats cracked against one another, and now agitated merchants were stepping warily back and forth as the battle between birds and felines progressed. A few chickens had escaped into the water and were flapping uselessly in little circles, squawking, for nature had conspired to make them even worse at swimming than they were at flying.
"Well," said a voice behind them, "have a look at this. These little wasters seem very likely."
Locke and the Sansas turned around as one, to see a half-dozen boys and girls their own age standing behind them, spread out across the alley. They were dressed much as the gentlemen bastards were, in unassuming clothes of common cut. Their apparent leader had a thick dark mane of curly black hair, pulled behind him and tied with a black silk ribbon. Quite a mark of distinction for an urchin.
Are you friends of the friends, lads? Are you the right sort of people?
The leader of the newcomers stood with his hands on his hips. Behind him, a short girl made several hand gestures used for common identification by Kappa Barsavi's subjects.
We are friends of the friends, said Locke. The rightest sort of right, added Galdo, making the appropriate counter-gestures.
Good lads. We're the seconds to the full crowns in the Narrows. Call ourselves half-crowns. What's your allegiance?
Gentlemen bastards, said Locke. Temple District.
Who are you seconds to?
We're not seconds to anyone, said Galdo. It's just the gentlemen bastards, one and all.
Savvy, said the leader of the half-crowns, with a friendly grin. I'm Tesso Valanti. This is my crew. We're here to take your coin, unless you want to kneel and give us your preference.
Locke scowled. Preference, in the parlance of the right people, meant that the gentlemen bastards would proclaim the half-crowns the better, tougher gang, make way for them on the street and tolerate whatever abuse the half-crowns saw fit to heap upon them.
I'm Locke Lamora, said Locke as he rose slowly to his feet, and accepting the kappa, the gentlemen bastards bend the knee to nobody.
Really?
Tesso feigned shock.
Even with 6-on-3?
It's soft talk, if knows your answer.
You must not hear very well, said Carlo,
as he and his brother stood up in unison.
He said you get our preference when you pick the peas out of our shit and suck on them for dinner.
Now that was uncalled for, said Tesso. So I'm going to make some noise with your skulls.
Even before he'd finished speaking, the half-crowns were moving forward, and it was 6-on-3 at the end of the pier. Locke was the smallest child involved, even counting the girls, and while he went into the melee with his little fists swinging, he caught mostly air and was quickly knocked down. One older girl sat on his back, while another kicked alley grit into his face. The first boy to reach for Carlo got a knee in the groin and went down moaning. Right behind him came Tesso, with a hard right that sent Carlo backward. Galdo tackled Tesso around the waist, howling, and they hit the ground, scrabbling for leverage. Soft talk meant no weapons, and no blows that could kill or cripple. But just about anything else was on the table. The Sanzas were capable brawlers, but even if Locke had been able to hold up his end of the fight, the numbers would have told against them. In the end, after a few minutes of wrestling and swearing and kicking, the three gentlemen bastards were dumped in the middle of the alley, dusty and battered.
"Right, lads. Preferences, is it? Let's hear 'em."
"Go fold yourself in half," said Locke, "and lick your ass."
"Oh, that's the wrong answer, shortwit," said Tesso.
And while one of his boys pinned Locke's arms, the leader of the half-crowns patted Locke down for coins.
Nothing. Well then, sweetmeats, we'll be looking for you again tomorrow, and the next day, and the next. Until you bend the knee, we'll watch you and we'll make your lives miserable. Mark my words, Locke Lamora.
The half-crowns strolled off, laughing, a few nursing bruises and sprains, but not nearly as many as they'd inflicted. The Sanzas arose groaning and helped Locke to his feet. Warily they limped back to the house of Perelandro together and slipped into the glass burrow through a drainage culvert equipped with a secret door.
"You're not going to believe what happened,"
said Locke as he and the Sanzas entered the dining room. Chains sat at the witchwood table, peering down at a collection of parchments, carefully scribing on one with a fine-cut quill. Forging customs papers was a sort of hobby, one he practiced the way some men kept gardens or bred hounds. He had a leather portfolio full of them, and he occasionally made good silver selling them.
Said Chains. "You got your asses walloped by a pack of half-crowns."
"How did you know?"
"Stopped by the last mistake last night. Heard about it from the full crowns. Told me their seconds might be sweeping the neighborhoods, looking for other juvies to push around."
"Why didn't you tell us?"
"I figured if you were being adequately cautious, they'd never be able to get the better of you.
Looks like your attention was somewhere else.
They said they wanted our preferences.
Yeah, said Chains. It's a juvie game. Most of the seconds don't get to pull real jobs just yet, so they train themselves up by pushing other seconds around. You should be proud of yourselves. You finally got noticed. Now you've got a little war until one of you cries mercy. Soft talk only, mind you.
So, Locke said slowly, what should we do?
Chains reached over and grabbed Locke's fist, then mimed swinging it into Carlo's jaw. Repeat as necessary, said Chains, until your problems are spitting up teeth.
We tried that, and they jumped us while Jean was away, and you know I'm not much good at that sort of thing.
Sure I do. So next time make sure you've got Jean with you, and use that devious little brain of yours.
Chains began melting a cylinder of sealing wax over a small candle. But I don't want to see anything too elaborate, Locke. Don't pull the watch or the temples or the Duke's army or anyone else into it. Try and make it look like you're just the pack of ordinary sneak thieves I tell everyone you are.
Oh, great.
Locke folded his arms while Carlo and Galdo washed one another's bruised faces with wet cloths.
So it's just another bloody test.
What a clever boy, muttered Chains, pouring liquid wax into a tiny silver vessel. Of course it is. And I'll personally be very upset if those little shits aren't begging and pleading to give you their preference before midsummer.
2. The next day, Locke and the Sansa brothers sat on the very same pier at the very same time. All over the shifting market, merchants were hauling down canvas tarps and furling canopies, for the rains that had drenched the city all night and half the morning were long gone.
I must be seeing things, came the voice of Tesso Volante, because I can't imagine that you shitwits would really be sitting there right where we beat the trouser gravy out of you just yesterday.
Why not? Said Locke, since we're closer to our turf than yours, and you're going to be using your balls for tonsils in about 2 minutes.
The three gentlemen bastards arose. Facing them were the same half-dozen half-crowns, with eager smiles on their faces.
I see you're none better at sums than you were when we left you, said Tesso, cracking his knuckles.
Funny you should say that, said Locke, since the sums have changed.
He pointed past the half-crowns. Tesso warily shifted his head to look behind him, but when he saw Jean Tannen standing in the alley behind his gang, he laughed.
Still in our favour, I'd say.
He strolled toward Jean, who simply looked at him with a bland smile on his round face.
What's this? A fat red bastard. I can see your glass eyes in your vest pocket. What do you think you're doing, fatty?
My name's Jean Tannen. And I'm the ambush.
Long months of training with Don Maranzala had left Jean looking little different than when he'd first begun, but Locke and the Sansas knew that a sort of alchemy had taken place beneath his soft exterior. Tesso stepped within his reach, grinning, and Jean's arms lashed out like the brass pistons in a Ferrari water engine. Tesso reeled backward, arms and legs wobbling like a marionette caught in a high wind. His head bowed forward, then he simply collapsed in a heap, his eyes rolling back in their sockets. A minor sort of hell broke loose in the alley. Three half-crown boys charged Locke and the Sansas. The two girls approached Jean warily. One of them tried to dash a handful of alley gravel in his face. He sidestepped, caught her arm, and swung her easily into one of the alley's stone walls. One of Don Maranzala's lessons. Let walls and streets do the work for you when you fight with empty hands. As she bounced backward, Jean clotheslined her with a swift hook from his right arm and sent her face first to the gravel.
It's not polite to hit girls, said her companion, circling him.
It's even less polite to hit my friends, said Jean.
She replied by pivoting on her left heel and snapping a swift kick at his throat. He recognized the art called chasson.
a sort of foot boxing imported from Tal Verar. He deflected the kick with the palm of his right hand, and she whirled into a second, using the momentum from her first to send her left leg whirling up and around. But Jean was moving past it before she struck. Her thigh, rather than her foot, slapped into his side, and he snaked his left arm around it. While she flailed for balance, he let her have a vicious kidney punch, and then he hooked her right leg out from beneath her, sending her to the gravel on her back, where she lay writhing in pain.
"Ladies," said Jean, "you must accept my deepest apologies."
Locke, as usual, was getting the worst of his encounter, until Jean grabbed his opponent by the shoulder and spun him around. Jean wrapped his heavy arms around the boy's waist and planted a headbutt in the boy's solar plexus. No sooner did the half-crown gasp in pain than Jean straightened up, cracking the boy's chin against the back of his head. The boy fell backward, dazed, and at that point the issue was decided. Carlo and Galdo had been evenly matched with their opponents when Jean suddenly loomed before them, with Locke at his side, doing his best to look dangerous. The half-crowns scrambled back and put their hands in the air.
"Well, Tesso," said Locke, when the curly-haired boy arose a few minutes later, bloody-nosed and wobbly, "will you be giving over your preference now, or shall I let Jean beat on you some more?"
"I admit it was well done," said Tesso as his gang limped into a semicircle behind him, "but I'd call us even at 1-1. You'll see us again soon."
3. So the battle went, as the days lengthened and spring turned into summer. Chains excused the boys from sitting the steps with him after the first hour of the afternoon, and they began roaming the north of Camor, hunting half-crowns with vigour. Tesso responded by unleashing the full strength of his little band. The full crowns were the largest real gang in Camor, and their seconds had a comparable pool of recruits, some of them fresh from Shades Hill. Even with the weight of numbers, however, the prowess of Jean Tannen was hard to answer, and so the nature of the battle changed. The full crowns split into smaller groups, attempting to isolate and ambush the gentleman bastards when they weren't together. For the most part, Locke kept his gang close at hand, but sometimes individual errands were unavoidable. Locke was beaten fairly badly on several occasions. He came to Jean one afternoon nursing a split lip and a pair of bruised shins.
"Look," he said, "it's been a few days since we had any piece of Tesso, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to lurk just south of the market tomorrow and look like I'm up to something. You're going to hide a long way off, 200 or 300 yards maybe, somewhere they can't possibly spot you."
"I'll never get to you in time," said Jean.
"The point isn't to get to me before I get beaten," said Locke. "The point is, when you do get there, you pound the crap out of him. You beat him so hard they'll hear the screaming in Talisham. Smack him around like you've never smacked him before."
"With pleasure," said Jean.
"But it won't happen. They'll only run away when they see me coming, as always. The one thing I can't do is keep up with them on foot."
"Just you leave that to me," said Locke, "and fetch your sewing kit. There's something I need you to do for me."
4. So it was that Locke Lamora lurked in an alley on an overcast day, very near to the place where the whole affair with the half-crowns had started. The shifting market was doing a brisk business, as folk attempted to get their shopping done before the sky started pouring down rain. Out there somewhere, watching Locke with comfortable anonymity from a little cockle-shell boat, was Jean Tannen. Locke only had to lurk conspicuously for half an hour before Tesso found him.
"Lamora," he said, "I thought you'd know better by now. I don't see any of your friends in the neighbourhood."
"Tesso, hello," Locke yawned. "I think today's the day you'll be giving over your preference to me."
"In a pig's fucking eye," said the older boy. "You know I don't even need help to knock you flat. What I think I'm going to do is take your clothes when I'm done and throw them in a canal. That'll be right humorous. Hell, the longer you put off bending the knee, the more fun I can have with you."
He advanced confidently to the attack, knowing that Locke had never once so much as kept up with him in a fight. Locke met him head on, shaking the left sleeve of his coat strangely. That sleeve was actually 5 feet longer than usual, courtesy of Jean Tannin's alterations. Locke had kept it cleverly folded against his side to conceal its true nature as Tesso approached. Although Locke had few gifts as a fighter, he could be startlingly fast, and the cuff of his sleeve had a small lead weight sewn into it to aid him in casting it. He flung it forth, wrapping it around Tesso's chest beneath the taller boy's arms. The lead weight carried it around as it stretched taut, and Locke caught it in his left hand.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
Tesso huffed. He clouted Locke just above his right eye. Locke flinched, but ignored the pain. He slipped the extended sleeve into a loop of cloth that hung out of his coat's left pocket, folded it back over itself, and pulled another cord just below it. The network of knotted cords that Jean had sewn inside his coat's lining cinched tight. Now the boys were chest to chest, and nothing short of a knife could free Tesso from the loop of thick cloth that tied them together. Locke wrapped his arms around Tesso's abdomen for good measure, and then wrapped his spindly legs around Tesso's legs, just above the taller boy's knees. Tesso shoved and slapped at Locke, struggling to part the two of them. Failing, he began punching Locke in the teeth and on the top of his head, heavy blows that left Locke seeing flashes of light.
"What the hell is this, Lamora?"
Tesso grunted with the effort of supporting Locke's weight in addition to his own. Finally, as Locke had hoped and expected, he threw himself forward. Locke landed on his back in the gravel with Tesso atop him. The air burst out of Locke's lungs, and the whole world seemed to shudder.
"This is ridiculous! You can't fight me, and now you can't run! Give up, Lamora!"
Locke spit blood into Tesso's face.
"I don't have to fight you, and I don't have to run!" he grinned wildly. "I just have to keep you here! Until Jean gets back."
Tesso gasped and looked around. Out on the shifting market, one small cockleshell boat was heading straight toward them. The plump shape of Jean Tannin was clearly visible within it, hauling rapidly on the oars.
"Oh, shit! You little bastard! Let me go! Let me go! Let me go!"
Tesso punctuated this with a series of punches. Soon enough, Locke was bleeding from his nose, his lips, his ears, and somewhere under his hair. Tesso was pounding him but good, yet he continued to cling madly to the older boy. His head was whirling with a combination of pain and triumph. Locke actually started laughing, high and gleeful, and perhaps a little bit mad.
"I don't have to fight or run," he cackled. "I changed the rules of the game. I just have to keep you here, asshole. Here until Jean gets back." "God damn it,"
Tesso hissed, and he redoubled his assault on Locke, punching and spitting and biting.
"Keep hitting," Locke sputtered. "You just keep hitting. I can take it all day. You just keep hitting me until Jean gets back."
Part 3. Revelation. Nature never deceives us. It is always we who deceive ourselves. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, from Émile ou de l'Éducation. Chapter 9. A Curious Tale for Countess Amberglass. 1. At 10:30 the 10th hour of the evening on Duke's Day, as low dark clouds fell in above Camor, blotting out the stars and the moons, Doña Sofia Salvara was being hoisted up into the sky to have a late tea with Doña Angiovesta Vorcenza, Dowager Countess of Amberglass, at the top of the great lady's elderglass tower. The passenger cage rattled and swayed, and Sofia clung to the black iron bars for support. The sweaty hangman's wing fluttered at her hooded coat as she stared south. All of the city lay spread beneath her, black and grey from horizon to horizon, suffused with the glow of fire and alchemy. This was a point of quiet pride for her every time she had the chance to take in this view from one of the 5 towers. The Eldrin had built glass wonders for men to claim. Engineers had crafted buildings of stone and wood in the Eldrin ruins to make the cities their own. Bonds Magi pretended to the powers the Eldrin must have once held. But it was alchemy that drove back the darkness every evening,
alchemy that lit the commonest home and the tallest tower alike, cleaner and safer than natural fire. It was her art that tamed the night. At last her long ascent ended. The cage rattled to a halt beside an embarkation platform 4/5 of the way up Amberglass full height. The wind sighed mournfully in the strange fluted arches at the peak of the tower. Two footmen in cream-white waistcoats and immaculate white gloves and breeches helped her out of the cage, as they might have assisted her from a carriage down on the ground. Once she was safely on the platform, the two men bowed from the waist.
"Milady Salvara," said the one on the left, "my mistress bids you welcome to Amberglass."
"Most kind," said Doña Sofia.
"If it would please you to wait on the terrace, she will join you momentarily."
The same footman led the way past a half-dozen servants in similar livery, who stood panting beside the elaborate arrangement of gears, levers, and chains they worked to haul the cargo cage up and down. They, too, bowed as she passed. She favoured them with a smile and an acknowledging wave. It never hurt to be pleasant to the servants in charge of that particular operation. Doña Vorcenza's terrace was a wide crescent of transparent elderglass jutting out from the north face of her tower, surrounded by brass safety rails. Doña Sofia looked straight down, as she had always been warned not to do, and as she always did. It seemed that she and the footman walked on thin air 40 stories above the stone courtyards and storage buildings at the base of the tower. Alchemical lamps were specks of light, and carriages were black squares smaller than one of her nails. On her left, visible through a series of tall arched windows whose sills were on a level with her waist, were dimly lit apartments and parlours within the tower itself. Doña Vorcenza had very few living relatives, and no children. She was effectively the last of a once powerful clan, and there was little doubt, among the grasping, ambitious nobles of the Alchegrante slopes at least, that Amberglass would pass to some new family upon her death. Most of her tower was dark and quiet, most of its opulence packed away in closets and chests. The old lady still knew how to host a late-night tea, however. At the far northwestern corner of her transparent terrace, with a commanding view of the lightless countryside to the north of the city, a silk awning fluttered in the hangman's wind. Tall alchemical lanterns in cages of gold-gilded brass hung from the four corners of the awning, shedding warm light on the little table and the two high-backed chairs arranged therein. The footman placed a thin black cushion upon the right-hand chair and pulled it out for her. With a swish of skirts, she settled into it and nodded her thanks. The man bowed and strolled away, taking up a watch at a point that was politely out of earshot, but within easy beckoning distance. Sofia did not have long to wait for her hostess. A few minutes after her arrival, old Doña Vorcenza appeared out of a wooden door on the tower's north wall. Age has a way of exaggerating the physical traits of those who live to feel its strains. The round tend to grow rounder, and the slim tend to waste away. Time had narrowed Angiovesta Vorcenza. She was not so much withered as collapsed, a spindly living caricature like a wooden idol animated by the sorcery of sheer willpower. 70 was a fading memory for her, yet she still moved about without an escort on her arm or a cane in her hands. She dressed eccentrically in a black velvet frock coat with fur collars and cuffs. Eschewing the cascading petticoats the ladies of her era had favoured, she actually wore black pantaloons and silver slippers. Her white hair was pulled back and fixed with lacquered pins. Her dark eyes were bright behind her half-moon optics.
"Sofia," she said as she stepped daintily beneath the awning, "what a pleasure it is to have you up here again. It's been months, my dear girl, months. No, do sit. Pulling out my own chair holds no terrors for me. Ah, tell me, how is Lorenzo? And surely we must speak of your garden."
"Lorenzo and I are well, considered solely in ourselves. And the garden thrives, Doña Vorcenza. Thank you for asking."
"'Considered solely in yourselves? "'Then there is something else? "'Something, dare I pry, external?'
"'A night tea in Camor was a womanly tradition "'when one wished to seek the advice of another, "'or simply make use of a sympathetic ear "'while expressing regrets or complaints, "'most frequently concerning men.'
"'You may pry, Doña Vorcenza, by all means. "'And yes, yes, external is a very proper term for it.
"'But it's not Lorenzo.'
"'Oh, no. Lorenzo is satisfactory in every possible respect.'
"'Sophia sighed and glanced down at the illusion of empty air "'beneath her feet and her chair.
"'It's both of us that may be in need of advice.'
"'Advice?' chuckled Doña Vorcenza. The years play a sort of alchemical trick, transmuting one's mutterings to a state of respectability. Give advice at 40 and you're a nag. Give it at 70 and you're a sage.
Doña Vorcenza, said Sophia, you have been of great help to me before. I couldn't think... Well, there was no one else I was comfortable speaking to about this matter for the time being.
Indeed. Well, dear girl, I'm eager to be of whatever help I can. But here's our tea. Come, let us indulge ourselves for a few moments.
One of Doña Vorcenza's jacketed attendants wheeled a silver-domed cart toward them and slid it into place beside the little table. When he whisked the dome away, Sophia saw that the cart held a gleaming silver tea service and a subtlety, a perfect culinary replica of amber-glass tower, barely 9 inches high, complete with minuscule specks of alchemical light dotting its turrets. The little glass globes were not much larger than raisins.
"'You see how little real work I give to my poor chef,' said Doña Vorcenza, cackling. "'He suffers in the service of such a plain and simple palate. He takes his revenge with these surprises.' I cannot order a soft-boiled egg, but that he finds a dancing chicken to lay it directly on my plate. Tell me, Gil, is that edifice truly edible?
So I am assured, my Lady Vorcenza, save for the tiny lights. The tower itself is spice cake. The turrets and terraces are jellied fruit. The buildings and carriages at the base of the tower are mostly chocolate. The heart of the tower is an apple brandy cream, and the windows...
Thank you, Gil. That will do for an architectural synopsis. But spit out the lights when we're finished, you say?
It would be more decorous, milady,
said the servant, a round, delicate-featured man with shoulder-length black ringlets, to let me remove them for you prior to consumption.
Decorous? Gil, you would deny us the fun of spitting them over the side of the terrace like little girls. I'll thank you not to touch them. The tea?
Your will, Doña Vorcenza, he said smoothly. Tea of light.
He lifted a silver teapot and poured a steaming line of pale brownish liquid into a tea glass. Doña Vorcenza's etched glasses were shaped like large tulip buds with silver bases. As the tea settled into the container, it began to glow faintly, shedding an inviting orange radiance.
"'Oh, very pretty,' said Doña Sophia. "'I've heard of it. Verrari, isn't it?'
"'Lasciani.'
Doña Vorcenza took the glass from Gil and cradled it in both hands.
"'Quite the latest thing. Their tea masters are mad with a competitive spirit.' This time next year we'll have something even stranger to one-up one another with. But forgive me, my dear, I do hope you're not averse to drinking the products of your art as well as working with them in your garden.
Not at all,
Sophia replied as the servant set her own glass before her and bowed. She took the cup into her hands and took a deep breath. The tea smelled of mingled vanilla and orange blossoms. When she sipped, the flavours ran warmly on her tongue, and the scented steam rose into her nostrils. Gil vanished back into the tower itself, while the ladies commenced drinking. For a few moments they enjoyed their tea in appreciative silence, and for a few moments Sophia was almost content.
"'Now we shall see,'
said Doña Vorcenza, as she set her half-empty glass down before her, "if it continues to glow when it comes out the other side."
Doña Salvara giggled despite herself, and the lines on her hostess' lean face drew upward as she smiled.
"Now, what did you want to ask me about, my dear?"
"Doña Vorcenza," Sophia began, then hesitated. It is commonly thought that you have some means to communicate with the Duke's secret constabulary."
"The Duke has a secret constabulary?"
Doña Vorcenza placed a hand against her breast in an expression of polite disbelief.
"The Midnighters, Doña Vorcenza, the Midnighters and their leader..."
"The Duke's spider. Yes, yes. Forgive me, dear girl, I do know of what you speak. But this idea you have, commonly thought, you say? Many things are commonly thought, but perhaps not commonly thought all the way through."
"It is very curious," said Sophia Salvara, "that when the Doñas come to you with problems, on more than one occasion their problems have reached the ear of the spider, or seemed to, since the Duke's men became involved in assisting with those problems."
"Oh, my dear Sophia, when gossip comes to me, I pass it on in packets and parcels. I drop a word or two in the right ear, and the gossip acquires a life of its own. Sooner or later it must reach the notice of someone who will take action."
"Doña Vorcenza," said Sophia, "I hope I can say without intending or giving offence that you are dissembling."
"I hope I can say without disappointing you, dear girl, that you have a very slender basis for making that suggestion."
"Doña Vorcenza,"
Sophia clutched at her edge of the table so hard that several of her finger joints popped,
"Lorenzo and I are being robbed."
"Robbed? Whatever do you mean?"
"And we have Midnighters involved. They've made the most extraordinary claims and made requests of us. But, Doña Vorcenza, there must be some way to confirm that they are what they say they are."
"You say Midnighters are robbing you?"
"No," said Sophia, biting her upper lip. "No, it's not the Midnighters themselves. They are supposedly watching the situation and waiting for a chance to act. But something is just wrong. Or they are not telling us everything they perhaps should."
"My dear Sophia," said Doña Vorcenza, "my poor troubled girl, you must tell me exactly what has happened, and leave out not one detail."
"It is difficult, Doña Vorcenza. The situation is rather embarrassing and complicated."
"We are all alone up here on my terrace, my dear. You have done all the hard work already in coming over to see me. Now you must tell me everything. Then I'll see to it that this particular bit of gossip speeds on its way to the right ear, I promise you."
Sophia took another small sip of tea, cleared her throat, and hunched down in her seat to look Doña Vorcenza directly in the eyes.
"Surely," she began, "you've heard of Osterschalin brandy, Doña Vorcenza?"
"More than heard of, my dear. I may even have a few bottles hidden away in my wine cabinets."
"And you know how it is made? The secrets surrounding it?"
"Oh, I believe I understand the essence of the Osterschalin mystique. The fussy, black-coated vintners of Emberlane are, shall we say, well served by the stories surrounding their wares."
"Then you can understand, Doña Vorcenza, how Lorenzo and I reacted as we did when the following opportunity supposedly fell into our laps by an act of the gods."
2. The cage containing Doña Salvara creaked and rattled toward the ground, growing ever smaller and fading into the background grey of the courtyard. Doña Vorcenza stood by the brass rails of the embarkation platform, staring into the night for many minutes, while her team of attendants pulled at the machinery of the capstan. Gil wheeled the silver cart with the near-empty pot of tea and the half-eaten amber-glass cake past her, and she turned to him.
"No," she said,
Send the cake up to the solarium. That's where we'll be.
Who, milady?
Reynard.
She was already striding back toward the door to her terrace-side apartments. Her slippered feet made an echoing slap, slap, slap against the walkway.
Find Reynard. I don't care what he's doing. Find him and send him up to me the moment you've seen to the cake.
Inside the suite of apartments, through a locked door, up a curving stairway, Doña Vorcenza cursed under her breath. Her knees, her feet, her ankles.
Damn venerability, she muttered. I piss on the gods for the gift of rheumatism.
Her breathing was ragged. She undid the buttons on the front of her fur-trimmed coat as she continued to mount the steps. At the top, the very peak of the inner tower, there was a heavy oaken door reinforced with iron joints and bands. She pulled forth a key that hung around her right wrist on a silk cord. This she inserted into the silver lockbox above the crystal knob, while carefully pressing a certain decorative brass plate in a wall sconce. A series of clicks echoed within the walls, and the door fell open, inward. Forgetting the brass plate would be a poor idea, she'd specified a rather excessive pull for the concealed crossbow trap when she'd had it installed 3 decades earlier. This was the solarium, then, another 8 stories up from the level of the terrace. The room took up the full diameter of the tower at its apex, 50 feet from edge to edge. The floor was thickly carpeted. A long, curving, brass-railed gallery with stairs at either end spread across the northern half of the space. This gallery held a row of tall witchwood shelves divided into thousands upon thousands of cubbyholes and compartments. The transparent hemispherical ceiling dome revealed the low clouds like a bubbling lake of smoke. Doña Vorcenza tapped alchemical globes to bring them to life as she mounted the stairs to her file gallery. There she worked, engrossed, heedless of the passage of time as her narrow fingers flicked from compartment to compartment. She pulled out some piles of parchment and set them aside, half-considered others and pushed them back in, muttering remembrances and conjecture under her breath. She snapped out of her fugue only when the solarium door clicked open once more. The man who entered was tall and broad-shouldered. He had an angular Vajran face and ice-blonde hair pulled back in a ribbon-bound tail. He wore a ribbed leather doublet over slashed black sleeves, with black breeches and tall black boots. The little silver pins at his collar gave him the rank of captain in the night-glass company. The black jackets, the duke's own, a rapier with straight quillons hung at his right hip.
"Stephen," said Doña Vorcenza without preamble, "have any of your boys or girls paid a recent visit to Don and Doña Salvara on the Isla Durona?"
"The Salvaras? No, certainly not, milady."
"You're sure? Absolutely sure?"
Parchments in hand, eyebrows arched, she stalked down the steps, barely keeping her balance.
"I need certain truth from you right now, as badly as I ever have."
"I know the Salvaras, milady. I met them both at last year's Day of Changes feast. I rode up to the Sky Garden in the same cage with them."
"And you haven't sent any of the Midnighters to pay them a visit?"
12 gods, no, not one."
"Then someone is abusing our good name, Stephen, and I think we may finally have the Thorn of Camor."
Reynard stared at her, then grinned.
"You're joking." "You're not? Pinch me, I must be dreaming. What's the situation?"
"First things first. I know you think fastest when we nurse that damned sweet tooth of yours. Peek inside the dumb waiter. I'm going to have a seat."
"Oh, my,"
said Reynard, peering into the chain-hoist shaft that held the dumb waiter.
"It looks as though someone's already made a merry work of this poor spice cake. I'll put it out of its misery. There's wine and glasses, too. Looks like one of your sweet whites."
"Gods bless Giel. I'd forgotten to ask him for that. I was in such haste to get to my files. Be a dear, dutiful subordinate and pour us a glass.
Dear, dutiful subordinate, indeed. For the cake, I'd polish your slippers as well.
I'll hold that promise in reserve for the next time you vex me, Stephen. Oh, fill the glass. I'm not 13 years old. Now, take your seat and listen to this. If everything signifies, as I believe it shall, the bastard has just been delivered to us right in the middle of one of his schemes.
How so?
I'll answer a question with a question, Stephen.
She took a deep draught of her white wine and settled back into her chair.
Tell me, how much do you know of the body of law surrounding Osterschalen brandy?
3. Posing as one of us, Reynard mused after she'd finished her tale. The sheer fucking cheek! But are you sure it's the thorn?
If it isn't, then we could only presume that we now have another equally skilled and audacious thief picking the pockets of my peers. And I think that's presuming a bit much, even for a city crammed as full of ghosts as this one.
Mightn't it be the Grey King? He's the right sort of slippery, by all reports.
No. The Grey King's been murdering Barsavi's men. The Thorn's mode of operation is plain trickery. Not a drop of real blood shed yet, as near as I can tell, and I don't think that's a coincidence.
Reynard set aside his empty cake plate and took a sip from his glass of wine.
So, if we can trust Doña Salvara's story, we're looking at a gang of at least 4 men. The Thorn himself, let's call him Lucas Fairwhite for the sake of argument, his servant Grauman, and the 2 men who broke into the Salvara estate.
That's a beginning, Stephen, but I'd say the gang is more probably 5 or 6.
How do you figure?
I believe the false midnighter was telling the truth when he told Don Salvara that the attack near the Temple of Fortunate Waters was staged. It would have to be for a scheme this complex. So we have 2 more accomplices, the masked attackers.
Assuming they weren't just hired for the task.
I doubt it. Consider the total paucity of information we've had previous to this. Not one report, one boast, one slender whisper from anyone, anywhere. Not a speck of information pointing to anyone who even claimed to work with the Thorn of Camor. Yet on any given day, thieves will boast loudly for hours about who among them can piss the farthest. This silence is unnatural.
Well, said Reynard, if you just slit a hireling's throat when he's done his job, you don't have to pay him either.
But we're still dealing with the Thorn, and I hold that such an act would be outside his pattern of operations.
So his gang runs a closed shop. That would make sense. But it still might not be 6. The 2 in the alley could also be the 2 who entered the estate dressed as midnighters.
Oh, my dear Stephen, an interesting conjecture. Let us say 4 minimum, 6 maximum is our first guess, or we'll be here all night drawing diagrams for one another. I suspect anything larger would be difficult to hide as well as they have.
So be it, then. Reynard thought for a moment. I can give you 15 or 16 swords right this very hour. Some of my lads are mumming it up tonight down in the snare on the cauldron, since we got those reports of Nazca Barsavi's funeral. I can't pull them on short notice, but give me until the dark of the morning and I can have everyone else kitted up and ready for a scrap. We've got the night glass to back us. No need to even bring the yellow jackets in on it. We know they're probably compromised anyway.
That would be well, Stephen, if I wanted them snatched up right now, but I don't. I think we have a few days, at least, to draw the web tight around this man. Sophia said they discussed an initial outlay of about 25,000 crowns. I suspect the Thorn will wait around to collect the other 7 or 8 he's due.
At least let me hold a squad ready, then. I'll keep them at the Palace of Patience. Tuck them in amongst the yellow jackets. They can be ready to dash off with 5 minutes' notice.
Very prudent. Do so. Now, as for how we move on the Thorn himself, send someone down to Maraggio's tomorrow, the subtlest you have. See if Fairwhite holds an account there, and when it was begun.
Calviro. I'll send Maralisa Calviro.
An excellent choice. As far as I'm concerned, anyone else this Fairwhite has introduced the Salvaras to is suspect. Have her check up on the law scribe she said her husband met just after the staged attack behind the temple.
Ecari, wasn't it? Evante Ecari.
Yes. And then I want you to check out the Temple of Fortunate Waters.
Me? Milady, you of all people know I don't keep the faith. I just inherited the looks.
But you can fake the faith. And it's the looks I need. They'll keep you from being too suspicious. Case the place. Look for anyone out of sorts. Look for gangs or goings-on. It's remotely possible someone at the temple was in on the staged attack. Even if that's not so, we need to eliminate it as a possibility.
It's as good as done, then. And what about their inn?
The Tumble Home, yes. Send one person and one person only. I have a pair of old informants on the staff. One of them thinks he's reporting to the Yellow Jackets, and one thinks she's working for the copper. I'll pass the names along. For now, I just want to find out if they're still there, at the Bowsprit Suite. If they are, you can place a few of your men there dressed as staff. Observation only, for the time being.
Very well. Reynard rose from his chair and brushed crumbs from his breeches. And the noose? Assuming you get your wish, where and when would you like to draw it tight?
Going after the Thorn has always been like trying to grab fish with bare hands, she replied. I'll want him sewn up somewhere, some place where escape will be impossible, cut off from his friends, and entirely surrounded by ours.
By ours? How? Oh, Raven's Reach.
Yes, very good, Stephen. The day of changes, just a week and a half from now. The Duke's Midsummer Feast. 500 feet in the air, surrounded by the peers of Camor and 100 guards. I'll instruct Doña Sophia to invite this Lucas Fairwhite to dine with the Duke as a guest of the Salvaras.
Assuming he doesn't suspect a trap.
I think it's just the sort of gesture he'd appreciate. I think our mysterious friend's audacity is going to be what finally arranges our direct introduction. I shall have Sophia feign financial distress. She can tell Fairwhite that the last few 1,000 crowns won't be forthcoming until after the festival. A double-baited hook, his greed hand in hand with his vanity. I dare say he'll relish the temptation.
Shall I pull everyone in for it?
Of course.
Doña Vorcenza sipped her wine and smiled slowly.
I want a midnighter to take his coat. I want midnighters serving him before the meal. If he uses a chamber pot, I want a midnighter to close it for him afterward. We'll take him atop Raven's Reach. Then we'll watch the ground to see who runs and where they run to.
Anything else?
No. Get to it, Stephen. Come back and let me have your report in a few hours. I'll still be up. I'm expecting messages from the floating grave once Barsavi's funeral procession gets back. In the meantime, I'll send old Nicovante a note about what we suspect.
Your servant, milady.
Reynard bowed briefly and then departed the solarium, his strides long and rapid. Before the heavy door had even slammed shut, Doña Vorcenza was up and moving toward a small scrivener's desk tucked into an alcove to the left of the door. There she withdrew a half-sheet of parchment, scribbled a few hasty lines, folded it, and closed the fold with a small dollop of blue wax from a paper tube. The stuff was alchemical, hardening after a few moments of exposure to air. She preferred to allow no sources of open flame into this room, with its many decades of carefully collected and indexed records. Within the desk was a signet ring that Doña Vorcenza never wore outside her solarium. On that ring was a sigil that appeared nowhere on the crest of the Vorcenza family. She pressed the ring into the stiffening blue wax and then withdrew it with a slight popping noise. When she passed it down the dumbwaiter, one of her night attendants would immediately run to the northeastern cage platform of her tower and have himself cranked over to Raven's Reach via cable car. There he would place the message directly into the old Duke's hands, even if Nicovante had retired to his bedchamber. Such was the custom with every note that was sealed in blue with nothing but the stylized sigil of a spider for its credentials. Interlude. The Schoolmaster of Roses.
No, this is my heart. Strike! Strike! Now here, strike!
Cold grey water poured down on the House of Glass Roses. Camor's winter rain pooled an inch deep beneath the feet of Jean Tannen and Don Maranzala. Water ran in rivulets and threads down the face of every rose in the garden. It ran in small rivers into Jean Tannen's eyes as he struck out with his rapier again and again at the stuffed leather target the Don held on the end of a stick, little larger than a big man's fist.
"Strike here! And here! No, too low! That's the liver! Kill me now, not a minute from now. I might have another thrust left in me. Up! Up at the heart, under the ribs! Better!"
Grey-white light exploded within the swirling clouds overhead, rippling like fire glimpsed through smoke. The thunder came a moment later, booming and reverberating, the sound of the gods throwing a tantrum. Jean could barely imagine what it must be like atop the five towers, now just a series of hazy grey columns lost in the sky behind Don Maranzala's right shoulder.
"Enough, Jean, enough. You're passing fair with a pig sticker. I want you to be familiar with it at need, but it's time to see what else you have a flair for."
Don Maranzala, who was wrapped up inside a much-abused brown oil cloak, splashed through the water to a large wooden box.
"You won't be able to haul a long blade around in your circles. Fetch me the woundman."
Jean hurried through the twisting glass maze toward the small room that led back down into the tower. He respected the roses still. Only a fool would not, but he was quite used to their presence now. They no longer seemed to loom and flash at him like hungry things. They were just an obstacle to keep one's fingers away from. The wound man, stashed in the little dry room at the top of the staircase, was a padded leather dummy in the shape of a man's head, torso, and arms, standing upon an iron pole. Bearing this awkwardly over his right shoulder, Jean stepped back out in the driving rain and returned to the center of the garden without fragrance. The wound man scraped the glass walls several times, but the roses had no taste for empty leather flesh. Don Maranzala had opened the wooden chest and was rummaging around in it. Jean set the wound man up in the center of the courtyard. The metal rod slid into a hole bored down through the stone and locked there with a twist, briefly pushing up a little fountain of water.
"Here's something ugly," said the Don,
swinging a 4-foot length of chain wrapped in very fine leather, likely kid.
"It's called a bailiff's lash, wrapped up so it doesn't rattle. If you look close, it's got little hooks at either end, so you can hitch it around your waist like a belt, easy to conceal under heavier clothes, though you might eventually need one a bit longer to fit around yourself."
The Don stepped forward confidently and let one end of the padded chain whip toward the woundman's head. It rebounded off the leather with a loud, wet whack. Jean amused himself for a few minutes by laying into the wound man while Don Maranzala watched. Mumbling to himself, the Don then took the padded chain away and offered Jean a pair of matched blades. They were about a foot long, one-sided, with broad and curving cutting edges. The hilts were attached to heavy handguards, which were studded with small brass spikes.
"Nasty little bitches, these things. Generally known as thieves' teeth. No subtlety to them. You can stab, hack, or just plain punch. Those little brass nubs can scrape a man's face off, and those guards'll stop most anything short of a charging bull. Have at it!"
Jean's showing with the blades was even better than his outing with the lash. Maranzala clapped approvingly.
"That's right! Up through the stomach, under the ribs. Put a foot of steel there and tickle a man's heart with it, and you've just won the argument, son."
As he took the matched blades back from Jean, he chuckled.
"How's that for teeth lessons, eh, boy? Eh?"
Jean stared at him, puzzled.
"Haven't you ever heard that one before? Your Kappa Barsavi, he's not from Camor originally. Taught at the Therin Collegium. So when he drags someone in for a talking to, that's etiquette lessons. And when he ties them up and makes them talk, that's singing lessons. And when he cuts their throats and throws them in the bay for the sharks..."
"Oh," said Jean, "I guess that'd be teeth lessons. I get it."
"Right. I didn't make that one up, mind you. That's your kind. I'd lay odds the big man knows about it, but nobody says anything like that to his face. That's how it always is, be it cutthroats or soldiers. So, next lovely toy."
Maranzala handed Jean a pair of wooden-handled hatchets. These had curved metal blades on one side and round counterweights on the other.
"No fancy name for these skullcrackers. I wager you've seen a hatchet before. Your choice to use the blade or the ball. It's possible to avoid killing a man with the ball, but if you hit hard enough, it's just as bad as the blade. So judge carefully when you're not attacking a woundman."
Almost immediately, Jean realized that he liked the feel of the hatchets in his hands. They were long enough to be more than a pocket weapon, like the gimp steel or the blackjacks most right people carried as a matter of habit, yet they were small enough to move swiftly and use in tight spaces, and it seemed to him they could hide themselves rather neatly under a coat or vest. He crouched. The knife fighter's crouch seemed natural with these things in his hands. Springing forward, he chopped at the wound man from both sides at once, embedding the hatchet blades in the dummy's ribs. With an overhand slash to the wound man's right arm, he made the whole thing shudder. He followed that cut with a backhanded stroke against the head, using a ball rather than a blade. For several minutes, he chopped and slashed at the wound man, his arms pistoning, a smile growing on his face.
"Hmm, not bad," said Don Maranzala. "Not bad at all for a total novice, I'll grant you that. You seem very comfortable with them."
On a whim, Jean turned and ran to one side of the courtyard, putting 15 feet between himself and the wound man. The driving rain thrust fingers of grey down between him and the target, so he concentrated very hard, and then he lined up and threw, whipping one hatchet through the air with the full twisting force of his arm, hips, and upper body. The hatchet sank home, blade flat on, in the wound man's head, where it held fast in the layers of leather without so much as a quiver.
"Oh, my!" said Don Maranzala.
Lightning roiled the heavens yet again, and thunder echoed across the rooftop.
"My, yes! Now there's a foundation we can build upon."
Chapter 10. Teeth Lessons. 1. In the darkness beneath the echo hole, Jean Tannon was moving even before the cask came crashing down into the black water, lit faintly from above by the red glow of Barsavi's torches. Beneath the ancient stone cube, there was a network of hanging rafters, built from black witchwood and lashed with elderglass cords.
The rafters were slimy with age and unmentionable growths, but they had surely held as long as the stones above had, and they retained their strength. The waterfall that cascaded in from the roof terminated here in one of the swirling channels beneath the rafters. There was a veritable maze of the things. Some were as smooth as glass, while others were as turbulent as whitewater rapids. A few wheels and even stranger devices turned slowly in the corners of the under-rafters. Jean had briefly appraised them by the light of a tiny alchemical ball when he'd settled himself in for a long wait. Bug, understandably unwilling to move too far from Jean's company, had crouched on a rafter of his own about 20 feet to Jean's left. There were little shafts in the stone floor of the echo hole, square cuts about 2 inches wide, irregularly spaced and serving some unguessable function. Jean had positioned himself between one of these, knowing that it would be impossible to hear any of the activities above with the noise of the waterfall right in his ear. His understanding of the situation above was imperfect, but as the long minutes rolled by, and the red light grew, and Kappa Barsavi and Locke began speaking to one another, Jean's uneasiness deepened into dread. There was shouting, cursing, the trample of booted feet on stone, cheers. Locke was taken. Where was the god's damned bondsmage? Jean scuttled along his rafter, looking for the best way to cross to the waterfall. It would be a good 5 or 6 feet up from the rafters to the lip of the stone gash through which the waterfall poured, but if he stayed out of the falling water, he could make it. Besides, it was the quickest way up, the only way up from within here. In the thin red light pouring down through the little holes in the floor, Jean signaled for Bug to stay put. There was another outburst of cheering above, and then the copper's voice, loud and clear through one of the peepholes,
"Take this bastard and send him out to sea!"
Send him out to sea? Jean's heart pounded. Had they already cut Locke's throat? His eyes stung at the thought that the next thing he'd see was a limp body falling in the white stream of gushing water, a limp body dressed all in grey. Then came the cask, a heavy dark object that plunged into the black canal at the base of the waterfall with a loud splash and a geyser of water. Jean blinked twice before he realized what he'd just seen. "Oh, gods!" he muttered. Like for like, Barsavi had to be fucking poetic. Overhead there was more cheering, more stomping of feet. Barsavi was yelling something. His men were yelling in response. Then the faint lines of red light began to flicker, shadows passed before them, and they began to recede in the direction of the street door. Barsavi was moving, so Jean decided to take a risk. There was another splash, audible even over the hiss and rumble of the waterfall. What the hell was that? Jean reached beneath his vest, drew out his light globe, and shook it. A faint white star blossomed in the darkness. Clinging tightly to the wet rafter with his other hand, Jean tossed the globe down toward the channel in which the cask would have fallen, about 40 feet to his right. It hit the water and settled, giving Jean enough light to discern the situation. The little channel was about 8 feet wide, stone-bordered, and the cask was bobbing heavily in it, three-quarters submerged. Bug was thrashing about in that canal, visible only from the arms up. Jean's light globe had struck the water about 3 feet to the right of his head. Bug had jumped down into the water on his own. Damn, but the boy seemed to be constitutionally incapable of remaining in high places for any length of time. Jean looked around frantically. It would take him a few moments to work his way over to a point where he could splash down into the right channel without cracking his legs against one of the stone dividers.
"Bug!"
Jean cried, judging that the ruckus above would cover his own voice.
"Your light! Slip it out, now! Locks in that cask!"
Bug fumbled with his tunic, drew out a globe, and shook it. By the sudden flare of added white light, Jean could clearly see the outline of the bobbing black cask. He judged the distance between himself and it, came to a decision, and reached for one of his hatchets with his free hand.
"Bug!" he yelled. "Don't try to get through the sides! Attack the flat top of the cask!"
"How?"
"Stay right where you are!"
Jean leaned to his right, clinging to the rafter with his left arm. He raised the hatchet in his right hand, whispered a single please to whatever gods were listening, and let fly. The hatchet struck, quivering, in the dark wood of the cask. Bug flinched back, then splashed through the water to pry at the weapon. Jean began sliding his bulk along the rafter, but more dark motion in the corner of his eye brought him up short. He peered down into the shadows on his left. Something was moving across the surface of one of the other waterways in the dammed maze. Several somethings, black scuttling shapes the size of dogs. Their bristling legs spread wide when they slipped just beneath the surface of the dark water, then drew in to propel them up and over stone just as easily.
"Fuck me," he muttered. "Fuck me, that's not possible."
Salt devils, despite their horrific size and aspect, were timid creatures. The huge spiders crouched in crevices on the rocky coasts to the southwest of Camor, preying on fish and gulls, occasionally falling prey to sharks or devilfish if they ventured too far from shore. Sailors flung stones and arrows at them with superstitious dread. Only a fool would approach one, with their fangs the length of a grown man's fingers, and their venom, which might not always bring death, but could make a man fervently pray for it. Yet salt devils were quite content to flee from humans. They were ambush hunters, solitary, incapable of tolerating one another at close quarters. Jean had scared himself witless in his early years reading the observations of scholars and naturalists concerning the creatures. Yet here was an entire pack of the damn things, leg to leg like hounds, scrabbling across stone and water alike toward Bug and the cask.
"Bug!" Jean screamed. "Bug!"
2. Bug had heard even less of the goings-on upstairs than Jean, yet when the cask had splashed down into darkness, he'd realized immediately that it hadn't been dropped down idly. Having placed himself directly over the canal that flowed from the waterfall, he'd simply let himself drop the 15 feet down into the rushing water. He'd tucked his legs and hit like a catapult stone, ass first. Although his head had plunged under with the momentum of his drop, he quickly found that he could plant his feet. The canal was only about 4 feet deep. Now, with Jean's hatchet gripped in one hand, he chopped frantically at the flat barrel top before him. He'd set his own light glass on the stone walkway beside the canal, as there was enough working light coming from Jean's beneath the surface of the water.
"Bug!"
the big man yelled, his voice suddenly loud with real alarm. "Bug!" The boy turned to his right and caught a glimpse of what was moving out of the far shadows toward him. A shudder of pure revulsion passed up and down his spine, and he looked around frantically to make sure the threat was approaching from only one direction.
"Bug, get out of the water! Get up on the stones!"
"What about Locke?"
"He doesn't want to come out of that cask right this fucking second," Jean hollered. "Trust me!"
As Bug scrambled up out of the rippling, alchemically lit water, the cask began once again bobbing toward the south end of the building, where the canal exited to God's knew where. Too desperate to think clearly about his own safety, Jean scrambled out along the crossbeam, feet sliding in the muck of the ages, and ran in the direction of the waterfall with his arms windmilling crazily for balance. A few seconds later, he arrested his forward momentum by wrapping his arms around a vertical beam. His feet slipped briefly out from beneath him, but he clung tightly to his perch. His mad dash had brought him to a point beside the waterfall. Now he flung himself forward into the air, carefully drawing his legs into his chest. He hit the water with a splash as great as that caused by the cask and bumped the canal bottom. He came up sputtering, second hatchet already in hand. Bug was crouched on the stone lip beside the canal, waving his alchemical globe at the spiders. Jean saw that the salt devils were about 15 feet away from the boy, across the water and moving more warily, but still approaching. Their carapaces were mottled black and grey, their multiple eyes the colour of deepest night, starred with eerie reflections of Bug's light. Their hairy pedipalps waved in the air before their faces, and their hard black fangs twitched. 4 of the damn things. Jean heaved his bulk up out of the canal on Bug's side, spitting water. He fancied that he saw some of those inhuman black eyes turn to regard him.
Jean, Bug moaned. Jean, those fucking things look pissed off.
It's not natural, said Jean as he ran to Bug's side.
The boy tossed him his other hatchet, and he caught it in the air. The spiders had closed to 10 feet, just across the water. He and Bug seemed hemmed in by 32 unblinking black eyes, 32 twitching legs with jagged dark hairs.
Not natural at all. Salt devils don't act like this.
Oh, good.
Bug held the alchemical globe out at arm's length, as though he could conceal himself entirely behind it.
You discuss it with them.
I'm sure we can communicate. I speak fluent hatchet.
No sooner were these words out of Jean's mouth than the spiders moved in eerie unison, forward into the water with four splashes. The cask had now drifted a few feet to Jean and Bug's right. One black shape actually passed beneath it. Multiple black legs speared upward out of the water, flailing for purchase. Bug cried out in mingled disgust and horror. Jean lunged forward, striking out with each hatchet in rapid downward strokes. Two spider limbs opened with stomach-turning cracking noises, spurting dark blue blood. Jean leapt backward. The two uninjured spiders pulled themselves up out of the water a few seconds ahead of their wounded brethren and rushed Jean, their barbed feet rasping against the wet stone blocks beneath them. Realizing he would be dangerously overbalanced if he attempted to swing on both at once, Jean opted for a more disgusting plan of action. The wicked sister in his right hand arced downward viciously, splitting the rightmost salt devil's head between its symmetrical rows of black eyes. Its legs spasmed in its death reflex, and Bug actually dropped his alchemical globe, so quickly did he leap backward. Jean used the momentum of his right-hand swing to raise his left leg up off the ground. The left-hand spider reared up with its fangs spread, just as he brought his boot heel down on what he supposed was its face. Its eyes cracked like jellied fruit, and Jean shoved downward with all his might, feeling as though he was stomping on a sack of wet leathers. Warm blood soaked his boot as he pulled it free, and now the wounded spiders were scuttling up right behind their fallen counterparts, hissing and clicking in anger. One shoved its way in front of the other and lunged at Jean, legs wide, head up to bare its curving fangs. Jean brought both the sisters down in a hammer blow, blade sides reversed, smashing the spider's head down into the wet stones and stopping it in its tracks. Ichor spurted. Jean felt it spattering his neck and forehead, and did his best to ignore it. One damn monster left. Incensed at the delay they'd caused him, Jean bellowed and leapt into the air. Arms spread, he landed with both of his feet in the middle of the last creature's carapace. It exploded wetly beneath him, folding the flailing legs up at an unnatural angle. They beat their last few pulses of life against his legs as he ground in his heels, growling.
"Gah!"
cried Bug, who'd gotten a good soaking from something blue and previously circulating through a salt devil. Jean didn't waste a second in tossing the boy one of his gore-soaked sisters before jumping down into the water once again. The cask had floated about 10 feet farther south. Jean splashed frantically toward it and secured it with his left hand. Then he began to piston his right arm up and down, hacking at the wood of the barrel's cover with his hatchet.
"Bug!" he cried. "Kindly make sure there aren't any more of those damn things creeping up on us!"
There was a splash behind Jean as Bug hopped back into the waterway. A few seconds later, the boy came up beside the cask and steadied it with his own thin arms.
"None that I can see, Jean. Hurry!"
"I am!" Crack, 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 fucking hurrying!
His hatchet blade bit through the wood at last. Horse urine poured out into the water, and Bug gagged. Working furiously, Jean widened the hole, then managed to pry off the end of the cask entirely. A wave of the foul, yellow-slick stuff swept out across his chest. Tossing his hatchet away without a further thought, he reached inside and tugged out the motionless body of Locke Lamora. Jean checked him frantically for cuts, slashes, or raised purple welts. His neck seemed to be quite intact. Jean heaved Locke rather urgently up onto the stone walkway beside the dead spiders, some parts of which were still twitching, then pushed himself up out of the water to crouch beside Locke. He wrenched off Locke's mantle and cloak. Bug appeared at his side just in time to yank them away and toss them in the water. Jean tore open Locke's grey vest and began thumping on his chest.
"Bug!" he gasped. "Bug! Get up here and push his legs in for me. His warm humours are all snuffed out. Let's get a rhythm going and maybe we can rekindle them. Gods, if he lives, I swear I'll get 10 books on physic and memorise every single one."
Bug clambered out of the water and began pumping Locke's legs, moving them in and out one at a time, while Jean alternately pressed on Locke's stomach, pounded on his chest, and slapped him on the cheeks.
"Come on, gods damn it," Jean muttered. "Be stubborn, you skinny little—"
Locke's back arched convulsively, and harsh, wet coughing noises exploded out of his throat. His hands scrabbled weakly at the stone, and he rolled over onto his left side. Jean sat back and sighed with relief, oblivious to the puddle of spider blood he'd settled into. Locke vomited into the water, retched and shuddered, then vomited again. Bug knelt beside him, steadying him by the shoulders. For several minutes, Locke lay there shaking, breathing heavily and coughing.
"Oh, gods,"
he said at last in a small, hoarse voice.
"Oh, gods, my eyes, I can barely see. Is there water?"
"Yes, running water." Jean reached over and took one of Locke's arms.
"Then get me in there. 13 gods, get this foulness off me."
Locke rolled into the canal with a splash before Jean or Bug could even move to assist him. He dunked his head beneath the dark stream several times, then began tearing off his remaining clothes until he was wearing nothing but a white undertunic and his grey breeches.
"Better?"
asked Jean.
"I suppose I must be,"
Locke retched again.
"My eyes sting, my nose and throat burn, my chest hurts, I've got a pounding black headache the size of Therim Pell. I got slapped around by the entire Barsavi family, I'm covered in horse piss, and it looks like the Grey King just did something pretty clever at our expense."
He set his head against the edge of the stone pathway and coughed a few more times. When he raised his head again, he noticed the spider carcasses for the first time and jerked backward.
"Ugh! Gods! Looks like there's things I've missed, too."
"Salt devils," said Jean. "A whole pack of them working together. They came on looking for a fight. Suicidal, like."
"That doesn't make any sense," said Locke.
"One thing could explain it," Jean replied.
"A conspiracy of the gods," Locke muttered.
"Oh, sorcery." "Yes, that bloody bondsmage. If he can tame a scorpion hawk, he could—"
"But what if it's just this place?" interrupted Bug. "You've heard the stories."
"No need to fret about stories," said Locke, "when there's a live mage known to have it in for us. Jean's right. I didn't get stuffed in that barrel as a criticism of my play-acting, and those biting bitches weren't here for a rest holiday. You were both meant to be dead as well, or if not dead—"
"Scared off," said Jean. "Distracted. The better for you to drown."
"Seems plausible."
Locke rubbed at his stinging eyes once again.
"Amazing how every time I think my tolerance for this affair has reached a final low, I find something new to hate. Carlo and Galdo, we need to get to them."
"They could be in a world of shit," agreed Jean.
"They already are, but we'll face it better once we're back together."
Locke attempted to heave himself up out of the water and failed. Jean reached down and pulled him up by the collar of his tunic. Locke nodded his thanks and slowly stood up, shaking.
"I'm afraid my strength seems to have fled. I'm sorry, Jean."
"Don't be. You've taken a hell of a lot of abuse tonight. I'm just pleased we broke you out of that thing before it was too late."
"I'm indebted to the pair of you, believe me. That was— it would have been—"
Locke shuddered and coughed again.
"It was pretty god's damned awful."
"I can only suppose," said Jean.
"Shall we go?"
"With all haste. Back out the way you two came in, quietly. Barsavi's crowd may still be in the area. And keep your eyes open for, birds."
"Too right. We came in through a sort of crawlway, western canal side." Jean slapped his forehead and looked around.
Damn me, I've mislaid the sisters.
Never fear, said Bug, holding them up. I figured you'd want them back, so I kept a watch on them.
Much obliged, Bug, said Jean. I'm of a mind to use them on some people before this night is done. 3. Rustwater was as dead as ever when they snuck out the crawlway and scrabbled up onto the canal bank just to the west of the echo hole. Barsavi's procession had vanished, and although the three gentlemen bastards crouched low and scanned the occulted sky for any hint of a swooping hawk, they caught not a glimpse.
"Let's make for Coal Smoke," said Locke. "Past Beggar's Barrow. We can steal a boat and slip home through the culvert."
The drainage culvert on the south side of the temple district, just beneath the house of Perelandro, had a concealed slide mechanism within the cage that covered it from the outside. The gentleman bastards could open it at will to come and go quietly.
"Good idea," said Jean. "I'm not comfortable being about on the streets and bridges."
They crept south, grateful for the low, warm mists that swirled around them. Jean had his hatchets out and was moving his head from side to side, watchful as a cat on a swaying clothesline. He led them over a bridge, with Locke constantly stumbling and falling behind, then down the southeastern shore of the quiet. Here the lightless black heap of Beggar's Barrow loomed in the mists to their left, and the wet stink of paupers' graves filled the air.
"Not a watchman," whispered Locke. "Not a Shades Hill boy or girl. Not a soul. Even for this neighbourhood, that's damn peculiar."
"Has anything about tonight been right yet?" Jean set as rapid a pace as he could, and they soon crossed another bridge, south into Coal Smoke. Locke laboured to keep up, clutching his aching stomach and ribs. Bug brought up their rear, constantly peering over his shoulder. On the northeastern edge of Coal Smoke there was a line of weathered docks, sagging stairs and crumbling stone quays. All the larger, nicer boats and barges were locked and chained, but a few small cockle shells bobbed here and there, secured by nothing more than rope. In a city full of such little boats, no sane thief would bother stealing one, most of the time. They clambered into the first one that chanced to have an oar. Locke collapsed at the stern while Bug took up the oar and Jean cast off the rope.
"Thank you, Bug."
Jean squeezed himself down into the wet bottom of the little wooden craft. All three of them made for a tight fit.
"I'll trade off with you in just a bit."
"What, no crack about my moral education?"
"Your moral education is over."
Jean stared up into the sky as the dockside receded and Bug took them out into the canal's heart.
"Now you're going to learn a thing or two about war."
4. Unseen and undisturbed, Jean quietly paddled them up against the north bank of the canal just south of their temple. The house of Perelandro was nothing more than a dark impression of mass, lightless in the silver fog above their heads.
"Smartly, smartly,"
the big man muttered to himself as he brought them abreast with the drainage culvert. It was about a yard up from the water, with an opening 5 feet in diameter. It led more or less directly to a concealed passage just behind the ladder that led down from the temple itself. Bug slipped a hand past the iron bars at the end of the culvert and tripped the hidden locking mechanism. He then prepared to climb in.
"I'll go first,"
he said, just before Jean grabbed him by the collar.
"I think not. The wicked sisters will go first. You sit down and keep the boat steady."
Bug did so, pouting, and Locke smiled. Jean pulled himself up into the culvert and began crawling into the darkness.
"You can have the honour of going second, Bug," said Locke. "I might need a hand pulling me up."
When all three of them were wedged safely into the pipe, Locke turned and nudged the little boat back out into mid-canal with his feet. The current would carry it to the Via Camorazza, lost in the mists, until someone ran into it with a larger boat or claimed it as a windfall. Locke then slid the pipe cover closed and locked it once again. The gentleman bastards actually oiled the hinges on the grate to keep their comings and goings quiet. They crawled forward into blackness, surrounded by the gentle echoes of their own breathing and the soft noise of scuffing cloth. There was a quiet click as Jean operated the hidden entrance into the burrow,
Then a line of pale silver light spilled in. Jean stepped out onto the wooden floor of the dim passage. Just to his right, the rungs ran up into the hidden entrance beneath what had once been Father Chain's sleeping pallet. Despite Jean's best effort to move quietly, the floor creaked slightly as he moved forward. Locke slipped out into the passage behind him, his heart pounding. The illumination was too dim. The walls had been golden for as long as he'd known the place. Jean crept forward, hatchets bobbing in his fists. At the far end of the passage, he whirled around the corner, crouched low, and then stood straight up, growling, "Shit!" The kitchen had been thoroughly trashed. The spice cabinets were overturned. Broken glass and shattered crockery littered the floor. The storage cupboards hung open, empty. The water barrel had been dumped on the tiles. The gilded chairs were torn apart, thrown into a heap in one corner. The beautiful chandelier that had swung above their heads for as long as any of them had lived within the glass burrow was a total ruin. It dangled now by a few wires, its planets and constellations smashed, its armillary paths bent beyond all possible repair. The sun that had burned at the heart of it all was cracked like an egg. The alchemical oils that had lit it from within had seeped onto the table. Locke and Jean stood at the edge of the entrance passage, staring in shock. Bug rounded the corner, hot for action against unseen foes, and came up short between them.
Gods! Gods!
Carlo! Locke abandoned all thoughts of sneaking about. Galdo! Carlo! Are you here? Jean swept aside the heavy curtain to the door that led to the wardrobe. He didn't say anything or make any noise, but the wicked sisters fell out of his hands and clattered against the floor tiles. The wardrobe, too, had been ransacked. All the rows of fine clothing and costume garments, all the hats and cravats and breeches and hose, all the waistcoats and vests and thousands of crowns worth of accessories, all of it was gone. The mirrors were smashed. The mask box was overturned, its contents strewn and broken across the floor. Carlo and Galdo lay beside it, on their backs, staring upward in the semi-darkness. Their throats were slashed from ear to ear, a pair of smooth gashes, identical twin wounds. 5. Jean fell forward onto his knees. Bug tried to squeeze past Locke, and Locke shoved him back into the kitchen with all the feeble strength he could muster, saying, "No, Bug, don't!" But it was already too late. The boy sat down hard against the edge of the witchwood table and broke into sobs. "Gods," Locke thought as he stumbled past Jean into the wardrobe. "Gods, I have been a fool. We should have packed up and run."
"Locke,"
Jean whispered. And then he sprawled forward onto the ground, shaking and shuddering as though he were having some sort of fit.
"Jean! Gods, what now?"
Locke crouched beside the bigger man and placed a hand beneath his round, heavy chin. Jean's pulse was pounding wildly. He looked up at Locke with wide eyes, his mouth opening and closing, failing to spit out words. Locke's mind raced. Poison? A trap of some sort? An alchemical trick left behind in the room? Why wasn't he affected? Did he feel so miserable already that the symptoms hadn't caught his attention yet? He glanced frantically around the room, and his eyes seized on a dark object that lay between the sprawled Sansa twins. A hand, a severed human hand, grey and dried and leathery. It lay with its palm toward the ceiling and its fingers curled tightly inward. A black thread had been used to sew a name into the dead skin of the palm. The script was crude, but nonetheless clear, for it was outlined with the faintest hint of pale blue fire. Jean Tannen.
"The things I could do to you if I were to stitch your true name."
The words of the falconer returned unbidden to Locke's memory. Jean groaned again. His back arched in pain, and Locke reached down toward the severed hand. A dozen plans whirled in his head. Chop it to bits with a hatchet, scald it on the alchemical hearth slab, throw it in the river. He had little knowledge of practical sorcery, but surely something was better than nothing. New footsteps crunched on the broken glass in the kitchen.
"Don't move, boy. I don't think your fat friend can help you at the moment. That's it. Just sit right there."
Locke slid one of Jean's hatchets off the ground, placed it in his left hand, and stepped to the wardrobe door. A man was standing at the lip of the entrance hall, a complete stranger to Locke's eyes. He wore a long brownish-red oil cloak with the hood thrown back, revealing long, stringy black hair and drooping black moustaches. He held a crossbow in his right hand, almost casually, pointed at Bug. His eyes widened when Locke appeared in the wardrobe doorway.
"This ain't right," he said. "You're not supposed to be here."
"You're the Grey King's man," said Locke.
His left hand was up against the back of the wall beside the door, as though he were holding himself up, concealing the hatchet.
"A Grey King's man. He's got a few."
"I will give you any price you name," said Locke. "Tell me where he is, what he's doing, and how I can avoid the bondsmage."
"You can't. I'll give you that one for free. And any price I name? You got no such pull."
"I have 45,000 full crowns."
"You did," said the crossbowman, amiably enough. "You don't any more."
"One bolt," said Locke. "Two of us."
Jean groaned from the floor behind him. "The situation bears thinking on."
"You don't look so well, and the boy don't look like much. I said don't move, boy."
"One bolt won't be enough," said Bug,
his eyes cold with an anger Locke had never before seen in him.
"You have no idea who you're fucking with."
"One bolt," repeated Locke. "It was for Bug, wasn't it? If I weren't here, you'd have shot him first thing, then done for Jean. A commendable arrangement. But now there's two of us, and you're still armed for one."
"Easy, gents," said the Grey King's man. "I don't see either of you eager for a hole in the face."
"You don't know what you're up against, what we've done."
Bug flicked his wrist slightly, and something fell into it from his sleeve. Locke only barely caught the motion. What was that thing? An orphan's twist? Oh, gods, that wouldn't do any good against a crossbow quarrel.
"Bug,"
he muttered.
"Tell him, Locke. Tell him he doesn't know who he's fucking with. Tell him he doesn't know what he's going to get. We can take him."
"First one of you moves an inch, I let fly."
The crossbowman backed off a stride, braced his weapon with his left arm, and swung his aim back and forth between Locke and Bug.
"Bug, don't!" "We can take him, Locke, you and I. He can't stop both of us. Hell, I bet he can't stop either of us."
"Bug, listen." "Listen to your friend, boy."
The intruder was sweating nervously behind his weapon.
"I'm a gentleman bastard," said Bug slowly and angrily. "Nobody messes with us. Nobody gets the best of us. You're going to pay."
Bug sprang upward from the floor, raising the hand that held the orphan's twist, a look of absolute burning determination on his face. The crossbow snapped, and the whip crack of its unleashed cord echoed sharply from the enclosed glass walls of the kitchen. The bolt that was meant to catch Bug between the eyes took him in the neck instead. He jerked back as though stung by an insect. His knees buckled only halfway into his leap, and he spun backward, his useless little orphan's twist arcing out of his hands as he fell. The Grey King's man threw down his crossbow and reached for a blade at his belt, but Locke was preceded out the doorway by the hatchet he'd concealed, flung with all of his rage. Jean could have split the man's head with the blade. Locke barely managed to crack him hard with the ball side of the weapon, but it was enough. The ball caught him just beneath his right eye, and he flinched backward, crying out in pain. Locke scooped up the crossbow and fell upon the intruder, howling. He swung the buttstock of the weapon into the man's face, and the man's nose broke with a spray of blood. He fell backward, his head cracking against the elderglass of the passage wall. As he slid down, he raised his hands before him in an attempt to ward off Locke's next blow. Locke smashed his fingers with the crossbow. The screams of the two men mingled and echoed in the enclosed space. Locke ended the affair by slamming one curved end of the bow into the man's temple. The assassin's head spun, blood spattered against the glass, and he sagged into the passage corner, motionless. Locke threw down the crossbow, turned on his heel, and ran to Bug. The bolt had pierced the boy's neck to the right of his windpipe, toward the outer edge of his neck, where it was buried up to its rounded feathers in a spreading pool of dark blood. Locke knelt and cradled Bug's head in his hands, feeling the tip of the crossbow quarrel on the back of Bug's neck. Slick warmth poured out over Locke's hands. He could feel it coursing out with every ragged breath the boy took. Bug's eyes were wide, and they fixed on him.
"Forgive me," Locke mumbled through his tears. "God's damn me, Bug, this is my fault. We could have run. We should have. My pride. You and Carlo and Galdo. That bolt should have been me."
"Your pride," the boy whispered. "Justified. Gentleman. Bastard."
Locke pressed his fingers against Bug's wound, imagining he could somehow dam the flow of blood, but the boy cried out and Locke withdrew his shaking fingers.
"Justified,"
Bug spat. Blood ran out of the corner of his mouth.
"Am I not a second, not apprentice, real gentleman bastard?"
"You were never a second, Bug. You were never an apprentice."
Locke sobbed, tried to brush the boy's hair back, and was aghast at the bloody handprint he left on Bug's pale forehead.
"You brave little idiot! You brave, stupid little bastard! This is my fault, Bug. Please, please say this is all my fault."
"No,"
whispered Bug.
"Oh, gods, hurts. Hurts so much."
The boy said nothing more. His breathing came to one last ragged halt while Locke held him. Locke stared upward. It seemed to him that the alien glass ceiling that had shed warm light on his life for so many long years now took a knowing pleasure in showing him nothing but dark red. The reflection of the floor on which he sat with the motionless body of Bug still bleeding in his arms. He might have stayed there, locked in a reverie of grief, for the gods only knew how long, but Jean groaned loudly in the next room. Locke remembered himself, shuddered, and set Bug's head down as gently as he could. He stumbled to his feet and lifted Jean's hatchet up off the ground once more. His motions were slow and unsteady as he walked back into the wardrobe, raised the hatchet above his head, and brought it down with all the force he could muster on the sorcerous hand that lay between the bodies of Carlo and Galdo. The faint blue fire dimmed as the hatchet blade bit down into the desiccated flesh. Jean gasped loudly behind him, which Locke took as an encouraging sign. Methodically, maliciously, he hacked the hand into smaller pieces. He chopped at leathery skin and brittle bones until the black threads that had spelled Jean's name were separated and the blue glow faded entirely. He stood staring down at the Sansas until he heard Jean moving behind him.
"Oh, Bug! Oh, God damn it!"
The big man stumbled to his feet and groaned.
"Forgive me, Locke. I couldn't move."
"There's nothing to forgive."
Locke spoke as though the sound of his own voice pained him.
"It was a trap. It had your name on it, that thing the mage left for us. They guessed you'd be coming back."
A severed hand? A human hand with my name stitched into it?"
"Yes.
A hanged man's grasp," said Jean, staring at the fragments of flesh and at the bodies of the Sansas. "I read about them when I was younger. Seems they work."
"Neatly removing you from the situation," said Locke coldly. "So one assassin hiding up above could come down, kill Bug, and finish you."
"Just one?"
"Just one." Locke sighed.
"Jean, in the temple rooms up above are lamp oil. Please fetch it down."
"Lamp oil?"
All of it, said Locke. Hurry. Jean paused in the kitchen, knelt and slid Bug's eyes closed with his left hand. He buried his face in his hands and shook, making no noise. Then he stumbled back to his feet, wiping away tears, and ran off to carry out Locke's request. Locke walked slowly back into the kitchen, dragging the body of Carlo Sanza with him. He placed the corpse beside the table, folded its arms across its chest, knelt and kissed its forehead. The man in the corner moaned and moved his head. Locke kicked him once in the face, then returned to the wardrobe for Galdo's body. In short order, he had the Sanzas laid out neatly in the middle of the ransacked kitchen, with Bug beside them. Unable to bear the glassy stare of his dead friend's eyes, Locke covered them with silk tablecloths from a smashed cabinet.
"I promise you a death offering, brothers," Locke whispered when he'd finished. "I promise you an offering that will make the gods themselves take notice. An offering that will make the shades of all the dukes and coppers of Camor feel like paupers. An offering in blood and gold and fire. This I swear by Azaguia, who gathers us, and by Perelandro, who sheltered us, and by the crooked warden who places his finger on the scale when our souls are weighed. This I swear to Chains, who kept us safe. I beg your forgiveness that I failed to do the same."
Locke forced himself to stand up and return to work. A few old garments had been thrown into the wardrobe corners. Locke gathered them up, along with a few components from the spilled mask box, a handful of false moustaches, a bit of false beard, and some stage adhesive. These he threw into the entrance corridor to the burrow. Then he peeked into the vault. As he'd suspected, it was utterly empty. Not a single coin remained in any well or on any shelf. No doubt the sacks loaded onto the wagon earlier had vanished as well. From the sleeping quarters at the back of the burrow, he gathered sheets and blankets, then parchment, books, and scrolls. He threw these into a heap atop the dining-room table. At last he stood over the Grey King's assassin, his hands and clothes covered in blood, and waited for Jean to return. 6. "Wake up," said Locke. "I know you can hear me." The Grey King's assassin blinked, spat blood, and tried to push himself even farther back into the corner with his feet. Locke stared down at him. It was a curious reversal of the natural way of things. The assassin was well-muscled, a head taller than Locke, and Locke was particularly unimposing after the events of this night. But everything frightening about him was concentrated in his eyes, and they bore down on the assassin with a bright, hard hatred. Jean stood a few paces behind him, a bag over his shoulder, his hatchets tucked into his belt. "Do you want to live?" asked Locke. The assassin said nothing. "It was a simple question, and I won't repeat it again. Do you want to live?"
Yes,
the man said softly. "Then it pleases me to deny you your preference." Locke knelt beside him, reached beneath his own undertunic, and drew forth a little leather pouch that hung by a cord around his neck. "Once," said Locke, "when I was old enough to understand what I'd done, I was ashamed to be a murderer. Even after I'd paid the debt, I still wore this. All these years to remind me." He pulled the pouch forward, snapping the cord. He opened it and removed a single small white shark's tooth. He grabbed the assassin's right hand, placed the pouch and the tooth on his palm, and then squeezed the man's broken fingers together around them. The assassin writhed and screamed. Locke punched him. "But now," he said, "now I'll be a murderer once again. I will set myself to slay until every last Grey King's man is gone. You hear me, cocksucker? I will have the bondsmage, and I will have the Grey King. And if all the powers of Camor and Carthane and hell itself oppose me, it will be nothing, nothing but a longer trail of corpses between me and your master."
"You're mad," the assassin whispered. "You'll never beat the Grey King."
"I'll do more than that. Whatever he's planning, I will unmake it. Whatever he desires, I will destroy it.
Every reason you came down here to murder my friends will evaporate. Every Grey King's man will die for nothing, starting with you. Jean Tannon stepped forward and grabbed the assassin with one hand, hauling him to his knees. Jean dragged him into the kitchen, oblivious to the man's pleas for mercy. The assassin was flung against the table, beside the three covered bodies and the pile of cloth and paper, and he became aware of the cloying smell of lamp oil. Without a word, Jean brought the ball of one of his hatchets down on the assassin's right knee. The man howled. Another swift crack shattered his left kneecap, and the assassin rolled over to shield himself from further blows, but none fell. "When you see the crooked warden," said Locke, twisting something in his hands, "tell him that Locke Lamora learns slowly, but he learns well. And when you see my friends, you tell them that there are more of you on the way." He opened his hands and let an object fall to the ground. It was a piece of knotted cord, charcoal grey, with white filaments jutting out from one end. Alchemical twist match. When the white threads were exposed to air for several moments, they would spark, igniting the heavier, longer-burning grey cord they were wrapped in. It splashed into the edge of a pool of lamp oil. Locke and Jean went up through the concealed hatch into the old stone temple, letting the ladder cover fall shut with a bang behind them. In the glass burrow beneath their feet, the flames began to rise. First the flames, and then the screams. Interlude. The Tale of the Old Handball Players. Handball is a Therin pastime, as cherished by the people of the southern city-states as it is scorned by the Vadrans in their kingdom to the north, although Vadrans in the south seem to love it well enough. Scholars belittle the idea that the game had its origin in the era of the Therin throne, when the mad emperor Satyrana would amuse himself by bowling with the severed heads of executed prisoners. They do not, however, deny it out of hand, for it is rarely wise to underestimate the Therin throne's excesses without the very firmest sort of proof. Handball is a rough sport for the rough classes, played between two teams on any reasonably flat surface that can be found. The ball itself is a rubbery mass of tree latex and leather, about 6 inches wide. The field is somewhere between 20 and 30 yards long, with straight lines marked, usually with chalk, at either end. Each team tries to move the ball across the other side's goal line. The ball must be held in both hands of a player as he runs, steps, or dives across the end of the field. The ball may be passed freely from player to player, but it must not be touched with any part of the body below the waist, and it must not be allowed to touch the ground, or possession will revert to the other team. A neutral adjudicator, referred to as the justice, attempts to enforce the rules at any given match, with varying degrees of success. Matches are sometimes played between teams representing entire neighborhoods or islands in Camor, and the drinking, wagering, and brawling surrounding these affairs always starts several days beforehand and ends when the match is but a memory. Indeed, the match is frequently an island of relative calm and goodwill in a sea of chaos. It is said that once, in the reign of the first Duke Andracana, a match was arranged between the cauldron and catchfire. One young fisherman, Marcos, was reckoned the finest handballer in the cauldron, while his closest friend, Gervain, was thought of as the best and fairest handball justice in the entire city. Naturally, the adjudication of the match was given over to Gervain. The match was held in one of the dusty, abandoned public squares of the Ashfall district, with 1,000 screaming, barely sober spectators from each side crowding the wrecked houses and alleys that surrounded the square. It was a bitter contest, close fought all the way. At the very end, the cauldron was behind by 1 point, with the final sands trickling out of the hourglass that kept the game's time. Marcos, bellowing madly, took the ball in his hands and bashed his way through an entire line of catchfire defenders. With one eye blackened, his hands bruised purple, blood streaming on his elbows and knees, he flung himself desperately for the goal line as the very last second of the game fell away. Marcos lay upon the stones, his arms at full extension, with the ball touching but not quite crossing the chalked line. Gervain pushed aside the crowding players, stared down at Marcos for a few seconds, and then said, "Not across the line. No point." The riot and the celebration that broke out afterward were indistinguishable from one another. Some say the Yellow Jackets killed a dozen men while battling it back. Others say it was closer to 100. At least 3 of the city's kappas died in a little war that broke out over reneged bets, and Marcos vowed never to speak to Gervain again. The two had fished together on the same boat since boyhood. Now the cauldron as a whole warned Gervain's entire family that their lives wouldn't be worth sausage casings if any one of them set foot in that district ever again. 20 years passed, 30, 35. The first Duke Nicovante rose to eminence in the city. Marcos and Gervain saw nothing of one another during this time. Gervain travelled to Jerash for many years, where he rowed galleys and hunted devilfish for pay. Eventually, homesick, he took passage for Camor. At the dockside, he was astounded to see a man stepping off a little fishing boat, a man weathered and grey and bearded just like himself, but certainly none other than his old friend Marcos.
"Marcos!" he cried. "Marcos from the cauldron! Marcos! The gods are kind! Surely you remember me?"
Marcos turned to regard the traveller who stood before him. He stared for a few seconds. Then, without warning, he drew a long-bladed fisherman's knife from his belt and buried it up to the hilt in Gervain's stomach. As Gervain stared downward in shock, Marcos gave him a shove sideways, and the former handball justice fell into the water of Camor Bay, never to surface again.
"Not across the line, my ass!" Marcos spat.
Verari, Carthani, and Lashani nod knowingly when they hear this story. They assume it to be apocryphal, but it confirms something they claim to know in their hearts, that Camori are all God's damned crazy. Camori, on the other hand, regard it as a valuable reminder against procrastinating in matters of revenge, or, if one cannot take satisfaction immediately, on the virtue of having a long memory.